is the best show here.
Best show! Best show! Best show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mind.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Link it up
and take it away. Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 209.
209
for September 12th, 2007. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Not good. Bad. How about you?
Hanging in there.
Dan is quiet all of a sudden.
Enough with the jibber jabber. Introduce our guest.
He's doing his compiling his kernel over there. You know, got to get a good start on that.
We got a fantastic guest, everybody. We got Bill Hurd, who is one of the more famous, notable engineers from Commodore Computers back in the day. Bill, welcome to the show. It's a real honor to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. As a matter of fact, you already reminded me of a story when you said the word kernel.
Don't leave us in suspense.
Yeah, don't leave us in suspense.
Okay, well, if you don't mind me just jumping in, we just attended the Vintage Computer Festival out on the East Coast here, the smaller version, I guess.
Where's that, Trenton?
What is the name of the place? Some little tiny town up in along the shore there, up in northern Jersey. But Chuck Peddle was there via Skype, and I had brought with me my friends Dave Haney and Bob Russell, and Bob was part of the VIC-20 and some of the Commodore 64 writing the code that was in it, and he's the guy that misspelled kernel and didn't know it, and nobody told him, and that's how we ended up with kernel spelled with an A-L, at least the Commodore version. I don't know if the Linux crowd spells it that way or not. But he just, you know, threw himself on the sword. So that one was mine. I misspelled it, and he ended up creating a whole thing out of it.
Cool.
So, not real exciting, but a lot of them, you'll find a lot of the stories. At least you get to learn. It's like, oh, is that how that happened? Okay, somebody dropped a cigarette on a listing or something.
Now, Bill, can you just go back to what your background was before you joined Commodore?
Well, back in... Gosh, it was the 70s. There really wasn't electronics. There wasn't any in your home except for a TV set. And I knew I had this thing for electronics, and I had been a CB repairman. The song Rubber Duck was on the radio, so everybody went out and bought one of those, and somebody needed them to fix it. And so my only real background was I'd been a TV repairman in a small town in Indiana. I was a high school dropout. And if I hadn't moved out of Indiana, I probably would be like a combine repairman to this day. I mean, there's just no technology there. So I ended up following my dad out. He moved out to Pennsylvania, and lo and behold, we moved close enough to the Westchester area, which is where Commodore, King of Prussia and then Westchester. So my background was I was a guy who knew how to fix almost anything and knew how to get in there and figure it out. And if I'm describing what people do these days on computers, it was kind of the same spirit. There was nobody around to tell you no, because there was nobody around to tell you yes. I mean, there were no computer courses that I knew of. People were building Heath computers, and, you know, we all read Popular Electronics, and that was my background. That was the extent of my formal education. I had gone to the National Guard and learned to fix teletypes. So that didn't really qualify for much of anything except I learned how to, like, blouse my my OD green pants into my boots, you know. So the kind of my personal background up to that was I had been a real hard partier that kind of led into our atmosphere at Commodore. And I had to even had some time on the street. I'd been living kind of on my own at the age of 15 and 16 and 17. You know, and then, like I said, ended up in the guard, which meant I had to learn to act civilized and eat with my hands at least once a month, and then go out and we'd get activated for riots and things like that. And I had a short-haired wig that I would put my long hair up under. So when I was in basic in Oklahoma, they shaved my head and did all that stuff. But as soon as you got back to your main post, you were allowed to start growing your hair out back then. So it was a strange mix. So I went into Commodore with no formal experience, a love of electronics, and a love of partying. And that's kind of how some of the computers came about. It was a mixture of all three of those things.
Was that the general, mix of people at Commodore, people who had really no formal education?
Well, there was a generational change, and at the time I got there, I didn't know it. When we got there, some amazingly bright people had just left, and I was so enthralled with the place and my head on a swivel looking around, I didn't catch everything. But it's like the chairs were still warm, there was still a cigar going in the ashtray, and yet I didn't know who these people were, and it took years and years to figure it out, because you're so busy there, you don't stop and do a history lesson about, well, whose chair was this? Who is that pedal guy, you know? It's kind of like, what's next? What do we do? And that had been a pretty formal era. When I first got there, we were up in King of Prussia. We were in the chip plant. There was three of us to a room, which, you know, you literally had two people had to scoot in while the third person scooted out on their chair. And it was, you know, those people had mostly degrees and whatnot, but they were scouring the Philadelphia area for people with talent to build out. And when we moved down to Westchester and we had all new digs and it was like a whole new building, and we even were, you know, we'd get hold of the plans and write our name in where we wanted our offices, it's like the rules changed. It was a bunch of young people. Jack Tramiel was kind of on his way out. There was a bunch of middle managers running around that, you know, without Jack, Jack was kind of like the wolf that kept the bunch of sheep down to, you know, the right number. Without Jack, the middle managers kind of proliferated, and it made chaos. And I thrived in the chaos, and several of us did. And so what happened in Westchester was, I'm kind of the person that people think of when they think of the trouble. I don't want to say troublemakers, but the partying crowd. It really started in about 1984, and it started around, I was the big long hair, my name was Animal, and nobody stopped us, so just we turned it into a big party. So the year before, no. The year after, yeah. So it was kind of a thing where, like I said, nobody stopped us from taking off and doing it. And because we were able to get the products out, I would walk in carrying a case of beer on my shoulder. I'd see the guard pick up the phone and kind of talking into it, and you could tell somebody had told him, leave him alone. You know, it got to that point where we, at least prior to a CES show, we had like this aura around us where nobody could mess with us.
Ah, yes, the infamous CES shows. For people who don't remember, CES was this trade show that they used to have every year where all the different companies would bring out their latest and greatest products that were coming out in the next year. And Commodore was one of the ones that were always there. My brother used to write for a Commodore magazine. He used to write for Ahoy, and he used to always go to the CES shows and always come back with lots of goodies and good stories about what was going on.
Yeah, it was a cool time. The CES show for us was like that one date you couldn't move. If you're working to a schedule for any other thing and you can convince your boss or your customer to let you slide a schedule by a week, you know, you can. But you can't move the CES show. So that was always the thing that gauged our the kind of ebb and flow of our lives. We would just work madly to get to the CES show. And then the week after was always strange because you see the people walking around the halls like zombies and they don't know what to do with them lives. And you have to go, like, tell them to go take baths and go home and take showers and stuff. You know, or go take a nap or something. Our suicide rate would just shoot way up right after a CES show, you know, as people didn't know what to do with themselves.
Lots of stress, little sleep.
Yeah, yeah. My record was 11 days without leaving the plant. I had a air mattress under my my desk, and other people would use it from time to time, but the I would at least work two shifts, because the day shift was when I had to interface with management, run around and keep all them, and then it was during the night that we actually got our stuff done. And my girlfriend at the time was one of the technicians. We had brought her in, so we would kind of hot bunk my air mattress. I'd work till 2 in the morning, come up with a solution, go wake her up and have her wire wrap something till 4:30 in the morning, and she'd wake me up and I'd go make it work, so we were able to like keep it going. And then during the day, I had different signs I could put on my door saying, you must, you know that sign at the fair that says you must be at least this tall to ride this ride?
Uh-huh.
I would have a sign that says, you must outrank a director to wake me up, or outrank this vice president. And I would have the guy's name. I'd have him sign it. It was kind of a joke. Where I would go, here, sign this thing saying that I can't be woken up unless you say it's okay. And I would put different ones on the door depending on how much sleep I had or how much sleep I needed. And that's how we get through the day.
So basically, if you hit your targets on your project, you're pretty much left alone to do what you wanted to do. Is that your statement?
Yeah, no. The direct managers knew who made their money. One of my managers walked around talking about the bonus he would get, just rubbing his hands. He was counting it. And there was other middle managers that just couldn't handle the attention the other people were getting, and they would do we called it pissing on the project, or if you'd find a crazy decision made, we called it urine. And what that meant was a manager tried to mark out his territory by, walking over and pissing on your project in some way. And if he could, like, screw with it a little bit, that he accomplished something. His name became, So they didn't stay out of our way. In fact, half of what I did there was battling management and strange people that had nothing to do with the project. The Commodore 128 was designed by literally a group of four people and then a couple guys in the chip department. And that's out of a department of about, 40 or 45. And it was cool because a small group of us came up with the idea and made it happen. And then when the time came, we had the power of a billion-dollar company to produce it. It's like, I called it the little big company. It was not designed by committee. In fact, all you had to do was stay ahead of the manager's bright ideas. If you would show something already working, they'd run around showing everybody, oh, look what my department did. But if you stopped too long, then they might come in with a description from marketing about what should be in there. So they couldn't catch us sometimes because we were nimble and kind of ahead of the ball. But with that said, I could tell you stories about the QA department and the CAD departments, how they each tried to like get involved with the project in kind of humorous ways.
I tell you what I really want to hear about, though, is I want to hear... what brought on this description of you, the guy who's known to punch through walls and wrestle executives in the hallways?
Yeah, I hope they remember more than that, but I'm not surprised that that's out there in front on my stuff because it's all true. And you don't hear about how I tried to throw Hedley Davis down the stairs with his chair and stuff like that at the local bars and stuff.
Nice.
But the... If I lead up to how holes appeared in the walls, lots of little things were thrown in our way. It was almost like it was there to make us tougher. It's like you had to fight for a pencil, and if you could beat the air guy for a pencil, then that meant you were stronger and more equipped to survive the Commodore. It felt like that. And I've had like the head of the CAD department try and jump me before my morning coffee, and it's like it's a firefight in the hallway even before things get started for the day. But we had a right in the middle of doing the project, they decided to rearrange the lab, and they're putting up new walls and stuff. And, of course, it's right in the middle of the project. I mean, it's October, November going into the CES show. Actually, it may start a little earlier. Was it August? But so the head of the QA department had been put in charge of this because he's such an important guy. And he's walking around. I swear to God, if he'd been a hard hat, he'd walked around with it with the plans under his arm, making sure everybody knew who he was. And they walled off one of the areas I was working where we had put in the emulator. It allowed me to pretend to be a 6510 processor. Nobody had done that before. We'd worked without emulators or without actual logic analyzers. And when they finished, the security guards, they've got a single-minded purpose that's actually kind of it's kind of interesting. Since there was a lock on the door to my area I work, they felt it must need to be locked. They locked it. Well, we work 7 days a week, so we come in Saturday. My door is locked. Not a problem. Oh, those happy security guards. And I climbed over the wall, and you get that white crap all over you, you know, from the false panels and stuff. And you drop down onto the other side and spill the coffee. It's been there for 3 days, and it's a pain in the ass. But, okay, won't happen again. Put up a sign. Please don't lock this door. There is no key for it yet, because they hadn't finished building the area and turning over the keys. Well, they locked the door again. And I put up a sign that said, look, guys, don't do it. No key. They locked the door again. Final sign was, you know, look, assholes, don't do this. There's no, and they locked it again. And the story was I punched through both layers of the wall in one punch. Well, that's not true. I punched one layer, and I punched it twice. But I punched the right next to the door through the walls so you could reach in and unlock the door. Now, this was still a pain in the ass because then your arm would get that white chalky crap all over it and everything. But, hey, we're in, and everybody's standing around, ooh, you know, her just put on, oh, he's going to get in trouble. And I'm, like, already working. You know, that was no big thing to me. Till the next day when I walk up, and they've locked my door. And I had to put a sign on it that said, look, you assholes, there is a hole in the wall next to the doorknob. There is no longer a reason to lock the door. And then the head of QA gets involved, and he's like, we're looking for the guy who punched the hole. I said, that was me. You know, he expected to, like, be able to make it into a detective whodunit. No, that was me. Door was locked. I had to get in. And everybody that knew we had to get done said, reasonable response, yes. And, you know, so me and that guy would cross over and over again. So that would become part of his status report. Well, we haven't got around to checking the code, but the hole in the wall has been patched or painted. And, you know, it took him 3 weeks to peel it over. And we went, and by that time, I think I had the doorknob off or something like that. So that's one of the holes in the wall. Another hole in the wall story involved a guy named Jeff Brannicky. Back then, I had I was twitchy, I guess you would call it. I called it being tuned. But when you've got a lot of adrenaline in you all the time, you get to this state where you can move quickly and probably hurt yourself in the process a lot of times. And what they would do is if I was carrying a cup of coffee, they would fake a punch at me to see if they could get me to throw my coffee on myself, which worked a couple times. Well, I modified my response routine to throw the coffee in the direction of wherever the punch came from. Only wrote a few lines of firmware code, and now everybody's getting coffee on them, including the bystander, so that kind of stopped. Well, Brannicky did one to me as I'm walking by. He did one of those fake half ones and then stopped, which meant if I'd thrown coffee, it would, you know, it's like, hey, that wasn't a full fake punch, the coffee. I remember I counted in my head. I counted one step, and I knew he was between his next step, the next two steps, turned and launched, and I gave him a double-handed shove that his foot never came down, you know, so he was completely off balance. Goes into the wall so far that we see the back of the urinals. And now this is the back, and this is the main hallway now, and the security guards had wanted to put cameras in, and I was told I was one of the reasons they wanted to put security cameras in the engineering area, and they had said, no cameras, we're doing bad things in here, so we'll just tell you that. So they had these security domes right outside our doors, and, you know, they're supposed to be so that they can swivel and you can't tell which direction they're looking.
Right.
I had taken a pair of those green dots and put them on the thing, so it looked like eyes. You could tell which direction they were looking. So you'd see these things swinging around, and we would do things like stop directly under it at 2 in the morning, and you'd see it looking around trying to figure out where you had gone, and you're standing directly under it. So we had no end of fun with the security guards. But you see this thing swinging around, and me and Jeff are, like, walking away like nothing happened. And so then, you know, you can imagine another hole in the wall got added to the QA report. You know. So the expression on Jeff's face was great, though, you know, as he sunk into the wall. So that's some of the hole in the wall stories there.
Now, you worked on a bunch of different machines. what was the biggest one for you? Was it the Commodore 128?
Yeah, it was the 128. I had also done the initial architecture of the LCD. And I had also been the head engineer at the end of the Plus 4 series called, we called it the TED. It became known as the Plus 4 series. And so if I back up a little bit, the Plus 4 series was kind of designed by the chip itself, the way they had used the chip. When I got there, there was already a design defined by it, but then I kind of took it across the line and made design changes and did all the dirty little things that, excuse me, that you do to, you know, actually get a product out. And then after the, after that rested, and we can talk about that, that computer more a little bit, it's a much maligned machine. There are some cute things about what that machine was supposed to be. I did the LCD architecture, and looking back, that was probably the one computer that stood a chance of breaking the mold and being the next original thing. And we owned the only LCD glass manufacturing company called Eagle Picture in America. All other LCD glass came from Japan, so we had a leg up on everybody. And then the glass that was out there those days was that stupid blue and gold stuff. If you remember the old Tandy LCD machines, mm-hmm. it was... 20 columns, it was 10 rows, 20 columns, some poor-ass thing. And we had nice kind of bluish-white, I mean, kind of nice display. And so I designed an MMU to go with it and some other things. It was all CMOS. And a guy that worked for me named Jeff Porter, who had come from AT&T, and he went on to become the vice president of engineering, it was obvious he could take it from there. By the way, he got associated with it because he knew modems. He was one of the few people I'd ever met back then that understood how to get a modem through FCC. And the whole point of the LCD was, oh, my God, it had a built-in modem. This is a mobile computer. And, I mean, that was a brand new. We still hadn't figured out how to make batteries work with it yet, but that it was going to be Commodore's first mobile computer. And so I kind of jumped off that, and the way I got onto the 128 was I had sat with my back. I was doing something in the lab. Freddie Bowen, who had done the kernel on the Plus 4 series, and Freddie had been there a long time. He came from MOS. He went on to do, like, the C65 and other things, but he was a kernel guy on the 128. And he's sitting with an engineer, and they're working on the on a passive logic analyzer as opposed to, like, the active one I was talking earlier. And they kept seeing three cycles instead of one every time I would go to do something. I've got my back to him. I'm listening to this. And I would keep hearing this, but I don't understand. How can it be doing that? It's not. And finally, after about an hour of this, I turn around. I grab the thing from him. I said, you've got contention. When you get contention, it bounces the ground in the probe, and it looks like three cycles to it. And I snatch the little PLA terms, the little logic terms. And I look at it, and he had photocopied it crooked, so he had missed a row at the very end. I'm like, here, you need a 1 here instead of a 0 because you're turning on two chips at once and they don't like it and this thing bounces. And I remember Freddie looking over his glass, and I turned back around and went back to work. So basically in less than a minute, I fixed the problem that had him going all day. I remember Freddie looking over his glasses at me going, and I kind of, that got the bug in me. I'm going, you know what they're working on? Boy, that's kind of interesting too. I wonder what they're kind of. So within a week, it's kind of Freddie had pulled and I kind of pushed, and I was on the, what I guess they called it, the B128 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to share the lead with somebody, and I just never, I didn't mean to be rude, but I ignored him. And I threw away the schematic, and I just started with the concept that it should be Commodore 64 compatible as well as we could make it, because I didn't know what that meant. I don't think anybody knew what 100% compatible meant. And we built one. And the first, literally, my boss, oh, that's cool, that's an interesting idea. And then they saw it working in, I guess, mid-August or something. And that's when Commodore decided it was coming up with, and remember, CES is like 5 months away. After they saw my demonstration board, that's when they decided that they were going to produce this Commodore 64 compatible machine that turns out to have 128 kilobits. And later I added a Z80 because they couldn't stop me. And you know, it just, we kept building on it. But then I found out the marketing went and shot their mouth off and said, oh, and it's 100% compatible. I'm like, I remember I just said, okay then, you know, and went back to work. And I'm like, boy, I wouldn't have said that, but okay, I like a nice high bar. Let's try and hit that. And that came from when I'd been at the previous CES show with the Plus 4, where I felt we had produced a pretty nifty little $49 computer. And as importantly, we had done what Jack Tramiel had asked us to do, and I have a lot of respect for Jack. People malign him and stuff. He made some mistakes. The more I listen to Chuck Peddle talk, I realize, wow, he made some huge things. But, you know, I've been in the service, and this guy was our general, you know, so he was the guy that you know, I followed and did what was told of me. And if he had still been around when the Plus 4 finished coming out, I think it would have competed with the Timex. You could get a Timex Sinclair for $49, and it was black and white, and the screen scrambled when you ran a program. And the TED had 121 colors, built-in sound, you know, all this different. It had bigger characters and a double speed clock and all this. For $49 or $79, depending on which sign you bought, it kicked ass. But without Jack around, management got involved, and they didn't have anybody to keep them in line. So they added this really bad software, and they tried to charge $399 for it. So I get to a CES show, and I get an earful of it because people assume it's my fault, and I didn't care. You know, it's just, trust me, the timing works on the inside. But that's where the idea of making something Commodore 64 compatible came from, was I had gotten an earful at the CES show. Now I've got a story about what it takes to. You guys jump in if I'm talking too much.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
The Commodore 128, it basically had three modes of operation, right? It had C64
yes.
mode for backward compatibility. It had C128
right.
mode, which was the default, and then
it had CPM
mode.
Yeah.
Now, what was the decision to go with a CPM mode? Were you guys trying to push into the business market to get people to, you know, buy these machines? To run CPM-based software?
I did it because there wasn't any reason not to. When I was doing my calculations and trying to make the 128, I got so excited if I could cut a dollar out of that thing. I used to keep a list of the prices in Akihabara, you know, or Singapore of what these chips cost and stuff. And my whole thing was to produce this behemoth of the 128 for, you know, our cost of $28 or something. And I did the calculation on the switching power supply, which was, before then we'd used analog supplies, and if you pulled too much current, they'd actually just get a little hotter and then they'd fail a little sooner, or your computer would crash a little more often, but it still would work. Well, with the switcher, it doesn't. It would either shut down or it'd blow the fuse. I looked at it, and I would have had to make the power supply bigger by half an amp to work with the CPM cartridge and like a modem cartridge. So that's in the back of my mind. It's not enough to move on yet, but I'm going, oh, half an amp. Oh, man, that's half an amp times 500,000. You know, that's 250,000 amps I'm wasting, you know. And then other things started to come up. The CPM cartridge plane didn't work. I have a memo. I found it just 4 months ago getting ready for the VCF where they're complaining about 20,000 CPM cards not working in production, and they're blaming the VIC chip timings. And they did that because the VIC chip was the most obvious thing in the Commodore. And so if I try to say that the CPM cartridge didn't work on the 128 because it was so 64 compatible, I didn't think that would sell. I couldn't say, see, it fails on mine, too. So I'm going, oh, man, the cartridge pulls too much current and it doesn't work. And I started thinking about it. And then I looked at it and I said, I can make this work better. If I put this thing in, then we can put out 80 column software integral to the thing. The day the 128 was going to come out, there would have been no 80 column software. We, you know, the game people weren't caught up to us yet. The 80 column chip had only been running for, you know, 2 days, 3 days before the CES show. And so I built it in one night. Again, you know, used my girlfriend, like, tapped on my foot, you know, at 5 in the morning when the wire wrap tower was done. And the next morning, we had a Z80 booting. And there was no need for CPM card. And we didn't even really tell everybody. We're just kind of sitting on that one, you know. But now I'm dual processor. The guy who was going to port CPM to the cartridge, just his name Von Erwein, very talented guy, he just started making it work on the internal one. And then my bosses caught on. They saw no reason to stop me. And then one day we sat down with the Magic Desk cartridge. The guys came in, and I liked these guys. They're really bright guys. They were the two guys that did the TI speak and spell, which back then, if you thought about it, was the first thing ever to talk. Blew us away the movie E.T., why would you have one hooked to a tree? Because it was just, you know, such a crazy, weird thing. They had this talking speech cartridge, magic voice, And when they plugged it into a 128, it crashed. And it crashed because there is these two signals that normally get soldered to ground for one kind of cartridge or not for the other. Well, they would actually sit out there, and right as you started up, they go, oh, you remember that signal that wasn't grounded is now. And it would just crash the computer. It's, you know, it'd flop the memory map right out from under it. And I looked at that, shooed everybody out, thanked them for all their help, waited till all the management left. And that night, we got into the reset logic and made the reset low instead of high, and high instead of low, depending on what part of the circuit. And so now the Z80 came on first. And the Z80 would look out the cartridge and go, oh, there's that Magic Voice cartridge sitting out there. Oh, man. And it would set up the MMU for C64 mode and then jump to the reset vector. And that's what the cartridge was waiting for. It's like a trapdoor spider waiting to see the reset vector for the 6502. Of course, we'd started at the other one, zeros, which was the Z80s. And it would just launch right into 64 mode. So the next day they walked in. QA manager's gloating, expecting, ha-ha, I've told him. And by the way, the QA manager, here's what he did. He would stand up and say, it won't work at some point in the project. And then at any time else in the project, he'd go, see, told you it didn't work. So he's already, the next day, he's had all night to gloat, to walk in and say, well, the Magic Voice cartridge proved to be the downfall of the 128, and it works. And now they can't make me take the Z80 out because it's how I boot the whole machine. So that's how the Z80 got in there. And I just remember thinking, all right, I'm fixing the power supply. I'm fixing the cartridge design. I'm offering 80-column software. And, by the way, it's how I boot reliably. Sure, I'll put it in there. You know, it was like, again, nobody around to stop me. And it was, and if nobody ever used it, I wouldn't have felt bad because it was just what we did was we would put things out there to be used. And then let the users decide what was valuable or not. I couldn't solve for that variable of what will be popular a year from now. You know? So that's kind of how the Z80 got out there. So, now, you mentioned one thing we did try and do on the 64. This is my one quick compatibility story. And it shows what we had to do to be Commodore 64 compatible. If you look at the old font on a Commodore 64, it's all jaggedy, and that's because we stole it from Atari. We called it the Atari font. And it was made for different cell sizes, like 4x6 or something. Well, we cleaned it up in the Commodore 128. We made the J's, the descenders go low, and we moved the dot above the J and the dot above the I and everything. And I had paid, you know, literally like with drinks or something. I had a snitch downstairs in the QA lab that would call me and tell me when there were problems. So I get a call one day. They said, they're on their way up. They found a problem with Qualipate. I'm like, all right. As I grab like a sandwich or something, the movie Dirty Harry was out. So, you know, I had that in my mind. So I'm standing there eating a sandwich when this whole rabble comes down the hallway. I mean, they've got pitchforks, and there's the QA manager going, you know, I told you it wouldn't work. And they show up, and I'm like, just calm down. I'm still eating. And we take it into the lab. The cartridge wouldn't work, and it was called Qualipane. We plugged it into the Commodore 64, and it would go, bing, welcome to Qualipane. And then it would, like, paint the K and the O and the L and the A on the screen, and then it would fill in the colors. It would fill in the K purple, and it would fill in the O red, and it would fill in the body of the I blue, and then it missed the dot on the I. And it's because they had taken the font from the character set and blown it up to be, like, you know, huge on the screen. Well, we had moved the dot on the eye, and it caused the whole thing. What it did is it painted the whole screen blue instead of just the dot on the eye blue. Matter of fact, when it was done, everything was blue except the dot on the eye. And what we learned from it was to be Commodore 64 compatible, you couldn't even move the dot on the eye. So, by the next day it was fixed. We took two ROMs. We soldered them on top of each other, and there was a wire that went to it. I had made a signal that I wasn't even using, but I figured I'd need it someday. And it was the signal that was high for 128 mode and low for 64 mode, and that became the upper address line for the font ROM. And that's how we fixed, what's funny at the end of the story is I start laughing, and I knew what it was. Everybody starts laughing. I look down, and there's still the sandwich in my hand I'd completely forgotten about. I'm like, what am I doing with this thing? You know, the emergency's over. I don't need a sandwich.
How about we talk a little bit about the Commodore LCD computer? It really was quite an interesting product that never really saw the light of day. And it was actually quite a shame because it looked to be a real interesting product from what I remember of it.
Yeah, Matter of fact, there's some pictures of it. I brought one. Nobody really believed they exist except for some old pictures, and I've got one at home, which is for sale for $20,000 if anybody wants to try and buy one off me. But I took it to the Vange Computer Festival, and some people took pictures of it. What I was going to say is there's some pictures that just surfaced of the 85 CES show, and you can see that half the inner part of the booth was dedicated to the LCD. And you see Ian Kirschman and Jeff Porter working on the, trying to hawk it and sell it. And Jeff and those guys did a great job of going out and finding buyers for it. They had, they went upstairs and talked and people agreed to buy 10,000, 15,000 of these. And the story goes that Marshall Smith, who was our CEO at the time, who supposedly came from U.S. Steel, except later I heard U.S. Steel said they don't know who he was, met with the president of Tandy and was told that there really was no money in mobile portable computers. And so basically the competitor told him not to bother. And I even saw a story like that somewhere. But then I saw the article, and I had this hanging outside my office, where it was the single highest-selling item of Tandy that year out of the Radio Shacks was the little stupid blue and gold LCD computer. So it was really sad, but it kind of denoted the problem with Commodore at the time. There was no real leadership that understood the technology world or what we had. And here they had orders for 50,000 when they said, no, let's not even bother. So it kind of met its demise there. It was interesting in a lot of ways. Had a built-in editor, nice editor. This was like an attempt to put good software in there instead of that horrible software that was in the Plus 4. And it had some other things going for it. We had sculpted the keys so that they were short-throw keys, but Mitsumi made them for us custom. But they were beveled, so they looked like they had some depth to them. And today, if you look at a laptop with the way the keys bevel out, we did that back in 1985, and it was the first time I'd ever seen one. So it was a cool little machine. Just met its normal Commodore death.
Yeah, I saw the video of you and Dave talking about it from some show that you guys did a couple of years back.
Ah, yeah.
I think it was on Google Video. I put the link on the URL.
Yeah, David stuck that up. What we were doing is we'd been asked to go out to the Commodore users groups, and when you own a small business, you just can't get away a lot of times, so we started making videos. And then we realized that, oh, my God, we can pull out boxes of stuff that we couldn't get through airport security with, but we could unload it on my conference room and show everybody some of the cool stuff that's out there. So it amazes me now when I see the size of those PC boards. I mean, these things are bigger than dinner plates. I mean, you could put tires on it and drag it, put a lawnmower on it and trailer at home, These things are huge. A great experience to pull out some of those. And there were some computers I hadn't seen, some of the Amigas and stuff that were supposed to save Commodore later. But again, if you didn't have management making decisions worth a poop, you were doomed,
That must have been really frustrating to see, to live through that day to day. You guys are putting your hearts and souls into these products. You're working your asses off. You're putting the hours in, and, the effort's not there for management. It's a real shame.
And I don't think it discouraged anybody that was good. Just considered that part of the obstacle course. Your knuckles would be bleeding. I mean, we went out. We were barroom brawlers and stuff. I mean, we worked so hard that we went out and took it out on the local wildlife, and just it was kind of like nobody thought to call us geeks back then, especially the hardware engineers. We were drinking Tabasco out of the bottle, doing every crazy thing we could. And we pretty much mowed right over the managers that were in the way. And, I had people tell me what a piece of crap the 128 is. And I'm like, that's cool. It sold 5 million. These people haven't been through it. And so, what wasn't a success for us still sold millions, and our definition of success was to get done. From there, it was up to somebody else. And so it's kind of like after you've been awake so long that you just get that happy dazed feeling of doing a reasonable job. We knew management was screwed up when we went into it, so the fact they were still screwed up when we were finished didn't surprise us. No. So it was. I only recently learned about the last days of Commodore. I read it in Brian Bagnell's book. I didn't know how it ended. I was off doing something else. And so I didn't know how they had ended by shutting the doors and how bad management had driven them into the ground. And I imagine that would have been very frustrating to have seen that once bustling place, you know, with the holes in the wall and everything, suddenly become the ghost town that it was. And, you know, they say there's Greg Berlin, like, prying a couple chips out of a computer before he leaves forever. He's like, oh, I figure I want to get something out of this, you know. And it's just like, oh. So it had been a really, really crazy time.
Well, what do you think of Brian's book? By the way, we had him on last year, and I thought he was a great guest.
Yeah, wow, there was so much there. I haven't read the whole thing. I jumped into the kind of the areas I knew, and I actually want to go back and read some of the pedal areas. Chuck Pedal, now that I've heard him speak and whatnot. But when I read the area from my era, I was laughing out loud, and maybe part of it was because I was filling in the backstory or whatnot, but he did catch a lot of it. I did feel like there was, that it was more of a narrative and less of a story, but I say that because to me it was a story. I saw the story unfold around me, and it's almost like I wish we could take the book and turn it into a once upon a time type thing and, you know, and give it an ending like that. So, but it's actually very informative about all the things that came before and after. Hearing Chuck Pedal speak the other, not too long ago, and what those guys did with the 6502, where, you know, microprocessors were the size of a small cabinet back then, and they said, let's make it into a chip. Why? Because you can sell stuff based on a chip. Why? Well, you could use this language BASIC as an operating system. What can you do with it? But it's like, those are the real pioneers, I think. The guys did the VIC-20 and the PETS and the 6502. Chuck was telling a story about how one guy named Steve Jobs bought his first 6502 for $25 out of a barrel at the suite. You know, and he's like, little did they know that three-quarters of the barrel was full of defective chips. And we, you know, I had to laugh because we had a jar full of defective chips in the lab at my place. And, you know, how that led, you know, off went Apple, you know. So thanks to this guy, indirectly, there's an iPod these days. Well, I've heard that Linus, you know, before doing Linux, worked on a VIC-20. And, you know, when he was young, and got some of the inspiration from there, and then Linux comes along. And then TiVo comes along, which to me is like the first really good use of a computer. Yeah? Because I can now actually watch TV any old time I want. And so in my mind, I'm going, whoa, thank you, Chuck Pedal and Linus and everybody, for my TiVo. And I should probably thank the people that actually developed the TiVo itself, but I figured they got paid to do it. But, you know, it's all the way things relate from one product to another. Who'd have guessed, you know, years ago when somebody was trying to make a processor not cabinet size, that I'd be able to skip commercials by pushing a button, you know. So it's all cool the way, and especially the way you see the open source initiatives these days, taking things, you know, to new heights and stuff, in spite of what the management, you know, if you kind of draw the relationship between corporate America and the management back at Commodore, they're saying one thing, and here you got the guys running around doing things just because nobody's stopping. You know, and that's kind of the parallel I draw with the open source community today.
Now you brought up Steve Jobs. The movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, have you ever seen that movie, Bill?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it portrays, it's mostly about Apple and Microsoft, and I think it portrays Apple incorrectly as being the dominant, you know, computer builder of the day.
The pioneers. Weren't they the pioneers?
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
of course,
I just...
Nothing happens if Apple doesn't make it so, you know?
Yeah. I did see one show on TV where, and it was the one where Steve Jobs is saying, cut a half a minute off the boot time, that'll save times a million people, you'll be saving so many people seconds a day, and I kind of like that thought, actually. But I froze the image as his prototype, and I went down in the basement, I got up, my wife's rolling her eyes meanwhile, and I hold a prototype up right next to the screen. And on the TV is a 6502 and a 6522 and a 6551. And in my hand is a wire wrap board that looks just like it, slightly different size. And there's a 6502, 6551, and a 6522. So basically, the thing he's famous for and the thing in my hand were the same computer, The one difference is I just looked at her and said, he's on TV because they made it and we went out of business, and to the person that lives the longest goes the spoils, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that is. Now, back then, we actually didn't know Steve's last name. We called him Steve Jobes. We thought that's how you pronounce his name. But every one of us knew how to say Wozniak. So and we knew about the Wozniak state machine and stuff like that. So we you know. But I've been in the room when they call, somebody will be on the phone. They're like, no, Bill, can you put on Dave? Yeah, yeah. Alan, how you doing, man? You know, and they're talking with Microsoft while there's nine people that work there, you know. and it's like, I guess Bill answered the phone and they wanted to talk to somebody else there, you know.
Well, if they ever make a sequel to Pirates of Silicon Valley, I'd say half of it has to be on Commodore.
I think they should. They forget, I mean, the Apple spawned from the work done by the early Commodore people and the MOS technology people. And hopefully Brian's book, you know, kind of brings that to the surface. I don't know if it really does or not, that real connection, that all that's downstream from the 6502 type of thinking.
Now, see, I always thought that there was no such thing as a personal computer until Steve Jobs and Wozniak put it together in their garage. That's...
Well, we did have some Apple IIs. As a matter of fact, if we wanted to play like one of the old board war games, we kept one, and we would load up Apple and sit in the corner and play it, you know, in all four colors or whatever it was. So we actually play, and Bob Russell had a Lisa that he did his, he had one of the five, I guess, that they made, or sold at least, Lisa computers out that were out there. But the, you know, you mentioned the personal computer, and now we just say PC, you know, it rolls off the tongue and everything. But I remember the first time I saw an IBM, and what occurred in my mind, I looked at it, and I knew it weighed 40 pounds, had to have. And just gauging, looking at it, I knew there had to be about 100, you know, 200 chips in it. And I'm going, there's designed by committee. You know, I looked down at, you know, my team where I'd done the original design, and then two guys, Frank Clay and Dave Haney, you know, helped me carry it across the line and make all the crap I had thought of actually work. So it was designed by a very small group of people and then put in and then you look at the IBM and 200 chips and all that stuff. But again, they're still around, so they get credit for the PC architecture. And I was actually kind of thankful because the people would bitch, you know how there was never enough interrupts, you know, in a PC, IRQ5 once it's taken and stuff. Well, if the frickin' Commodore architecture had caught on, you guys would be really yelling at us because we only had, like, IRQs and NMIs and stuff. We didn't, you know. So in a way, I was kind of glad that our stuff died off during it, when it was appropriate. let's see here. I'm trying to think of
you know what?
Any other little tidbits or anything.
I got to say, about the Commodore, I've always been pissed off at the Commodore computer because my dad wouldn't let me get a Commodore. He said it was a game machine. He made me get a TI-99-4A, and I couldn't have games. I had to program my own games, which in a way was a good thing, but... Everybody had a Commodore, except me.
Right, right.
And now I feel left out.
I remember the TI-99 well, because about the year the 128 was out, they developed a problem in their power supply, where it would overheat and the insulation would drip out, and then the chassis could become electrically hot. And they got forbidden to sell it for about 7 months. And during that time, we came out with that, hey, send us your computer, and we'll give you $99 off on your Commodore 64 promotion. And that was a stroke of genius by Jack Tramiel, because what it did was it got all those computers off the street, which got all the software for those computers off the street. And so we had a skid. A guy named Yash Terakura sent down to the basement and had him bring up a skid of all, you know, when you send all those computers in, they had to go somewhere. And I still have my Kim 1 that I pulled out of the pile from that day.
Oh, cool.
I pulled out a Timex Sinclair and used it as a doorstop, and guess where the first Z80 came from the night I said we built it into the board? I actually had to take apart my doorstop to get one, because we didn't have Z80s in stock at that time. We bought the cartridges already soldered from someplace. And so my doorstop gave its life to be the first 128 with a Z80 in it.
That's funny.
Yeah. We used to... some people had sent in as part of the video games that came with it were these realistic looking guns that had like the optosensor in the barrel. And I latched onto a couple of those, and so I would go to, if we were going to have a bad meeting, I would actually walk in the meeting and set this plastic gun that looked real on the table, and somebody had even pointed at the guy that knew I was going to unload on that day. And so, you know, our reputation as gunslingers, we set up like a, we took the styrofoam that we got all these TV sets in when we figured out we had blown the video signal and couldn't make the TV work right. We set up a knife-throwing range alongside one of the conference rooms, and it had targets on both ends, so you could throw your knives down one way, walk down, grab them out, and throw them back the other way. So it was kind of, there was a little bit of the Wild West going on there. I'm going to pick on the QA manager once here. Let me do this. This was the guy that would stand up on a table and you know, say, hey, I told you it wouldn't work. he tried to get me fired at one point where we had made a mistake in the 128 in the PLA terms. And what it is back then we didn't have computers to check stuff for us. We had to do a lot of things by hand. And the listing, if you held it straight out at shoulder level, would go almost to the floor, and on there was a zero, or there was an X instead of a one in one place. And it meant that the soccer game developed in England would not work in multicolor character IO mode or something like that. And so I go to a meeting, and there we've got like two VPs and a president. We got the president of MOS, who is also the vice president of Commodore, and the chief operating officer of Commodore, and the two QA guys, the QA guy from downstairs in production and the QA guy from upstairs. And he's got this pile of paper in front of him, and I see what's on top. It's like a memo from me or something. And he goes, well, first off, you know, we know it was you that made the mistake. We know that you released the part to production and the cost of that. And I said, yeah, I fucked up. Here's how we're going to fix it. And he clears his throat and he nudges this paper. And he goes, no, we have proof. And I go, yes, I fucked up. So here's how we're going to fix it. I saved half of it. And what I'd done was I'd saved half the batch at MOS. I'd held it back and we could do a certain kind of change called a layer 456 change. And this guy wasn't going to have, you know, he's like, well, wait a minute, you don't understand. I know it was you. And I'm like, at this point, I just stopped talking, and I looked at him. And the president of MOS cleared his throat, and the room goes quiet. And you hear this guy, you know, he's one of those people that all he had to do was shift his weight a little bit, and everybody would, like, shut up. And he goes, I think Bill has it in under control if you would listen to him. And the other QA manager had been sitting next to the first one. You actually saw him shift from his left arm to his right arm and lean away from the guy that was trying to get me fired. And this poor guy is looking at this pile of paper that he had produced to prove that I did the thing I admitted I did the first minute of the meeting. And for, you know, poor guy had to leave knowing he couldn't get me fired that day. So that was kind of the battle between me and this QA guy. This guy was a real piece of work. One day he walked in to sadly announce that the printers had failed the drop test. We're like, wow, shoot, okay, those things are expensive. We were really hoping to, you know, release a printer with the new release of the 128. So how bad was it? Well, it's pretty bad, you know, parts, you know, just everything. And really, all three of them. And he said something about the parts everywhere, and I'm like, you're shitting me. The box broke open so bad that the parts went everywhere? And the guy goes, box? And we're looking at him going, you did three? You know, because he was dropping, he was doing a regulation drop test from a certain height that represents a loading dock with printers with no box on them. These printers cost $40,000 each, and that's a lot of money back then. And when one shattered, I mean, I'm told the pieces went out in the hallway, right? He proceeded to drop the two more. So that was our QA manager. So we knew we were on our own when it came to trying to get quality out the door. Bill. I'll quit picking on the QA guy now.
What exactly did you leave for Commodore, Bill?
You know, I don't know. The years are kind of fuzzy. It would have been, I guess, 86. It was after the 128, and we didn't really... I was part of the Amiga team for a while. Unfortunately, by that time, I had gotten addicted to the adrenaline of always being on the edge. And, you know, later in life, I realized I should have just slowed down, you know, taken like a 5-month break and waited for the next computer to pop up. but I quit and went off to try to be a director of engineering for some other place that turns out that they really didn't want Bill Hurd working for them, you know, because it's like they didn't like me showing up with a fifth of whiskey and stuff like that at work, you know. I should have just hung out and been part of the woodwork, but, you know, that's the problem when you do this stuff to such extremes is you don't know how to stop when the time comes, you know.
So what have you been doing after Commodore, your post-Commodore days? What have some of the projects been involved in?
Well, I've done a lot of things. I've done some high-speed computers, early digital signal processors. I've designed video cameras. You know, like about 15 years ago, I started an ISP and sold that recently, and we do programming now. What have I done? Did something not too long ago where something you could hold in your hand could tell the denomination of dollar bills for the blind, which is a lot harder than it sounds because you have, you know, so many different types of bills and so many different conditions and shapes and denominations and stuff. But the interesting thing about that, why I bring it up, is that the computer, the chip that I used had the cycle time of the old Cray XMP computer, you know, back in the 80s. Excuse me. You can now hold that in your hand and it's battery powered. You know, so the how far we've come in 20 years was just absolutely amazing that we could put that kind of processor stuff into your hand.
So what kind of setup do you have now? What's your, you know, PC setup or what are you using?
You know, I probably have 8 or 9 in the house, and you know, the boys got one. The boy, my son, who is confusing his teachers a little bit, so I'm sure he'll be like a chip off the old block. And what was interesting with that was he was using a computer at the age of 2 and 3. I had to buy a 5-pack of CD-ROM drives because he would put the CDs in the drive with jelly still on them, and that would tend to ruin the drive, which the managers used to do in the old days, you know, so I saw a lot of... But the, you know, since I ran an ISP, which we started with basically a Pentium, a DX260 and a Pentium 90, and I had thousands of customers running off that. I ran it on BSDI Unix, and now we have, you know, all kinds of application servers and heavy RAID servers and stuff. There are actually not. I came back to work here tonight to do something, and so about 50 feet from me are about 50 machines that make up the business that we had started here. You kind of get out of it. I mean, it's kind of a thing I do for a living. And somebody has asked me, well, do you still use a Commodore computer? And I'm like, well, why would I? I have this multi-gigabit machine that I replace every 9 months that sits next to my desk. And I can run anything I want at any speed I want. If I want to, I will emulate the Commodore 64 codes, you know, and still have to put in delay loops so it runs at the right speed. So it's kind of, machine du jour is kind of what it is. I don't chase the last megabit, but there's some cool things out there. I think my house needs an Asterisk server. That should be the next project.
That's what we're on right now, an Asterisk server.
Isn't that amazing? You know, what phone companies tell you, you need to pay a lot of money for it's open source, and it's probably as good or better quality as what you can spend $20,000 on a voice system for, you know. Having set one up for my business long before Asterisk, actually before Linux was really out. Linux was just coming out when we started. And so we worked with the Berkeley Unixes back then. So how's the Linux world these days? Live and kicking? What kind of feedback do you guys get on the kind of things that come across the show?
Hate mail.
Dan's joking.
Oh, you're going to get some after tonight. Did I use bad words or anything?
No, we'll get love mail from this episode. Unless Link screws up and starts spewing off his freedom-hating attitude.
Bite me.
Yeah. That's it right there. That's right. I mean, do you keep up with any of the stuff in the Linux world?
Dan badmouthed me when Dan is probably the only one talking to you tonight that did not have a Commodore.
I know. I feel so ashamed.
But he tried to make the TI work for everything it was worth.
That's right. That's right. You know, the interesting thing is my dad tried so hard to keep games off of the TI. We eventually got it. And back in the day, Infocom games were like the greatest games. I love those. Mm-hmm. And I was playing Infidel, and I got right to the end of Infidel, and just as I was opening up the sarcophagus, my disk drive fuse burned out. And I couldn't get to the end of the game.
Sarcophagus.
And it's just, I was so upset. And to this day, I've never been able to finish the game again. Never been able to go back.
Yeah, for some reason, I don't seem to be able to play the old Wolfenstein, you know? It just doesn't do the same for me these days.
I know, I hear you. But I mean, do you keep up with any of the information or any of the stuff going on in the Linux world or in the free software, free and open source software world in general?
Yeah, I do. Because my company is so internet-based, we actually use like Debian variants on Linux, and I'm really looking forward to the day that Ubuntu and machines like that become good, solid desktop alternatives. I do have one on an AB switch on my desk that I play Mahjong with and, you know, some other things. But I look for the day when choices become a matter of choice again. And, you know, 3 years ago it was really bad in that you had to buy a Microsoft if you wanted to interface to other companies and send them files and things. Except my lawyer. For some reason, he liked WordPerfect on DOS. But other than him, we had to use Windows on with everything. So, yeah, everything from, like, Spam Assassin, we mentioned Asterisk. You know, these open source initiatives that are out there doing something. Again, I'll go back to, it seems to me just nobody told them they couldn't be successful at it, so they went ahead and did it.
You know, back in the heyday of Commodore, I mean, what was the general attitude with regards to sharing information? Was it all kept under lock and key and secret and worrying about patent infringement and other people's ideas? I mean, because like today, there's big brouhaha about whether or not open source or free software might infringe upon somebody's intellectual property. And we got patents going crazy. Software patents all over the place. That it's an environment of fear to actually develop and program in. Was there the same type of situation going on, particularly with the hardware back then?
No, other than, you know, the guys that did the 6502 had come from Motorola. They had worked on the 6801, and when they came over and they made it called the 6501, they got sued, so they changed it and called it the 6502. And then there were some patents on some of the chips. But Commodore did something nobody else could, and so we didn't think anybody could catch us, and that was we made our own chips. Apple, PC, all those guys, you open that stuff, and it's all somebody else's chip. And so you couldn't replicate. We didn't care if you knew what the code was. You know, I mean, we were building in ROM monitors by that time into our machines. You just couldn't build one, nor could you get it out under the tree. I mean, our whole advantage was we thought of it in August, and it's under the tree come January. You know, so how could you compete with that, you know? So it wasn't about somebody else in the industry. And again, we're even on the East Coast. I wasn't even aware of the West Coast mentality and Silicon Valley and all that. I've never actually been exposed to it where everybody's so close to each other that all you have to do is walk in, you know, a block away to be talking to the wrong people, you know. So it was pretty open. We got a complaint when we built a ROM monitor into the Plus 4, you know, where you could actually disassemble the code that's doing the disassembly of the code. And we got a telex. Remember telexes? Before there were faxes, there were telexes.
Mm-hmm.
We get a telex from the head of Commodore England saying, we have now created the perfect machine for hacking software. And I sent her back a two-word telex that just said, thank you. Now, I don't think she meant it that way, but...
Yeah, the Commodore 64s, when they came out, the user guide had, I forget whether it was either in the front or the back, but they would include the schematics.
Yep. Yeah.
Which was really, really fantastic thing to do back then.
And pieces of the code. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the word kernel misspelled.
If anybody
right
did
there,
that now, someone would be having a stroke, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny to see one of those schematics and then see, you know, a mistake I made years ago that never got corrected. Or somebody posted some pictures the other day trying to figure out what something was. It was about 4 months ago. And I looked at it, and there's my handwriting when I was 24 years old. I wasn't sure if I felt old or young right at that moment, but to see your own handwriting on something 24 years later is just like, oh, my God. So those schematics are definitely a blast from the past.
Now, you worked a little bit with the Amiga, didn't you?
Very little. I got exposed to it when they were still looking at it. I got the manuals that showed, you know, the Amiga was a game machine originally, and so the manuals I saw had little pictures of tanks in them. There was no word processor or anything like that. And so, you know, I was there when they first came in, and then I was supposed to be in charge of the PAL version, but that time I was really on my way out. So Dave Haney, a guy that worked for me, went on to do lots of Amiga-type things, and so it was like the next wave. The thing that was sad about the Amiga was we watched marketing on the 128, you know, sit there and say, well, it's a shitty machine, no wonder it doesn't sell. We go, whatever. We did our job. And then when the Amiga came out, we watched them. It's like they put their feet up on the desk, and they said, aha, at last, a good machine. Now it will sell. But they did nothing more than they did on the 128. I only ever saw like one Amiga commercial that confused the hell out of me. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It was supposed to be the dawn of a new generation, and they showed a fetus floating in something. We called it baby on a stick. You know, I mean, if you ever saw how they made the commercial, it was a fetus with a popsicle stick stuck in it. And it's like really crude, actually. But it's like, what the hell is that commercial? That's an Amiga commercial? And so the Amiga died the same death of not being marketed. And this is all in the vacuum left by Jack Tramiel having left. He was never really replaced with a person who understood the need for technology. The guys that worked there had worked for Coca-Cola and Nabisco, stuff like that. They didn't look for somebody that understood what a computer actually did.
You have to
understand, managers those days and corporate officers didn't use computers. They dictated into little magnetic things, and then their secretaries would type them. So they themselves didn't even use computers, nor know how to use them.
I think a lot of executives these days still don't know how to use computers or know what they do exactly.
Ah, but they still try, and then they call somebody after they break it.
It's
but,
still
yeah,
magic.
I agree. Yes. Yeah, you know what? There is no... You know, when I see something, I see why it works or why it's broken and whatnot. You know, I'm hoping my son picks up on that. But I've been fixing things since I was 12 years old. I fixed my dad's light organ. The thing used to flash to lights back in the 70s. And it was all rock and roll-ish. And I realized that if I replaced a component, it would work again. And since then, whenever I look at something, I've used that phrase, there's no magic. I see what's under it. And when I go to magic shows, I it's like you figure out the tricks, and that's cool. You know, and my wife feels sorry for me. She's like, oh, there's no magic in your world. I'm like feeling sorry for her because I'm like, you're fooled by magic, you know.
A lot of great stuff.
Yeah, sorry for babbling so much, but it's...
It's good stuff.
It's hard to catch just a glimpse of the environment that there was. And, you know, to walk around seeing, like, me with long hair and no shirt carrying a table, something I'd torn off of a table over my shoulder, you know, threatening to beat people that got in my way and stuff. I mean, and people that lived there. There was one guy. Difference between me and him was I would actually take a shower. I would either go to some of the local people's houses or some of the girls I knew in the area and hit them up for a shower, or I would stand in the bathroom and take a bird bath shower, we used to call it. And then he used to turn off the hot water at night, and I would go and I would fill it up in the vice president's hot water pot. I would fill up the thing. I would take a hand cloth bath out of. But this other guy who we really loved, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we were all friends, and he was good. You respected somebody if they were good, and you tolerated them if they were polite. But he would sleep in the office, not borrow with showers and stuff, and he would take bubble wrap and put it all up like under a desk and something, and he would go up there and sleep in this bubble wrap, and we called it nesting. And you would, like, be looking for George, and you'd look under a thing, you'd see a foot sticking out of bubble wrap, and it's, oh, we found him. And later he'd be walking around with, like, those little red circles on his face. You knew he'd been sleeping in the bubble wrap again.
That's pretty strange.
Yeah, yeah, George was pretty strange. He had a mission, though. His mission was little Unix boxes to take over the world. And this, you got to remember, this is the early 80s, or mid-80s, you know, when he said that.
That's right. Commodore had a version of Unix for a while.
The Z8000. He was part of the Z8000 team. They made a good try. They wanted to get a 18 or 16-bit machine out there. There was a lot of reasons why the Zilog was the way to go over the Motorola at that time, and it just, unfortunately, they just didn't get it out. So, parallel to all the things we're doing, we're kind of, you know, I knew I was consumerish. I knew my computer's main job was to play games because that's what I used them for. Matter of fact, when I first walked down the hall of the Commodore, and you walk by, people would be playing games in plain view and probably doing their jobs, or they're so bad at their regular job, you're glad they're playing games, some of them. I'm like, cool, I'm in the right place. And then there was the Z8000, which was okay, and there's a business team over there. They're doing, you know, the word process, and unfortunately, they never got it out the door. But, you know, it felt good to be that you had two offerings, at least, to know that there was a business track in addition to the consumer track. And I think that's why you saw the Amiga go that way then, is we had yet to really produce a business machine at that time.
We got a question from the RC. Someone wants to know, what was your toughest programming challenge while you were at Commodore?
I'll take programming to mean anything that really dealt with getting the computer out. And I'm trying to think of what the software guys may have said there. When they first did the code for BASIC, nobody had written more than 64K before. K, you know, I still have to remind people we used K back then instead of M, and then everybody, like, rolls their eyes when I do that. So to write to 128K, we had to do all this banking and everything of registers in and out. And I had done some things where we tried to leave. You could, like, put some stuff in a place, switch banks, and at least there's your baggage waiting for you on the other side. So there was some people would sat there and said, well, the 128's BASIC is slower than the 64, but what they guys had to do was do something that had never been done before and do it in a short period of time, and that was manage a memory management unit. That was probably the first consumer. It wasn't a full-blown one. I didn't put in a supervisor mode, which I should have. So it was a most of an MMU, but it was the first consumer one, and still get BASIC out and do all the Terry Ryan put into that BASIC. He put these commands, loop while, do until, all these structured commands, because we had read this thing called Real Programmers Don't Eat Quiche. And in there, it's all about whether you use the go-to statement or not. And he got told that if he put that in there, he would get fired. And he put it in there anyways because it was the right thing to do. And his boss came to him and said, I'm going to do a voice here because that's how he talked. He's like, well, while I see that it was indeed the best thing perhaps to have done, you nonetheless did not do what I told you to. You get a 3% raise. And so he didn't get a raise. We all got these big raises except the guy who did this structured BASIC. So that was interesting to see. The biggest challenge we had dealt with an 80-column chip, and I've actually, you can see some writings on the Internet about there about on the hardware side where we lived with a chip that just, we couldn't get them to get it right in time for CES show. I think they only made about 8 of them before the CES show. I'll tell one, there was another programming challenge in there, and it was right at the time of the CES show, and this was a guy did an amazing thing. The 80-COM chip, every rev had a new problem, and while they're trying to solve problems, they're actually introducing new ones, and I had done things like found if I soldered to the little tab and grounded it out, the tab that's supposed to indicate which end of the chip is up. I could make it work better, and I would run the voltage up 2 extra volts and do all these crazy things. Well, the guy that wrote CPM, which was going to be half of the 128 part of the booth, was going to be a demonstration of CPM. He stopped using new revs at rev 3, and we were up to rev 7 And, I mean, each rev cost us $500,000 to run. And he would keep his working. He would take the little butter melter out of a Mr. Popcorn or Buttercup popcorn popper, and he would put an ice cube in it, and he would put that little tin cup on the top of his 80-column chip, and he was good for about 20 minutes before he had to go get another ice cube. And that's how he got CPM done on time. Well, when we met at the CES show, and he put his newest code in our machines, and our machines had the newest 80-column chip that we just barely got working. I mean, I used to tweak. I had resistors hanging off them to make them work, and I had phase lock. I had this little tower. I phase lock looped the 80-column chips to the VIC chip just to make them work for the CES show. And what would happen was, as he scrolled upwards, it would leave a character behind, just like the Matrix videos do. You know, the intro to the Matrix, how it kind of looks like tears falling down the screen. So the longer you scrolled the screen, the more characters got left behind, and it would tear up the screen. And we told him, I said, no, man, you should have been using the Rev 7 chip. We had to do this one change where you have to write to the register different because the chip designer just finally gave up and changed it. And he didn't have what it took to compile CPM that night at the CES show. We are in the booth. We are upstairs. We threw the salespeople out of their little suite thing. We've got this room. Matter of fact, you can see the room on the pictures of the 85 CES show that's out there. He used a disk editor, figured out what the opcodes would be to write to it correctly, wrote it using a disk editor where he had to write the sectors backwards and then write the entire, he had to write the code backwards in the sector and then the sectors backwards on the disk, and he had to hand calculate opcodes so that the checksum was the same when he was done. So he basically hand modified CPM the night of the CES show, including the checksums on a disk using a disk editor, and the next morning when the sun came up in Las Vegas, the screens were perfect. So that was one of the unsung. That guy's name was Von Ertwein that did that. And so that's just, and that was typical. That was a typical night. We clapped him on the back. Said, nice one, you know, because we could all count on each other to pull out their end when it fell onto them. So that's an example of the kind of pressures we were under at the time.
Were those kind of pressures, I mean, were those going across other companies like that? I mean, was everybody, you know, running by the seat of their pants? Or was
Well, you figure IBM must have had 100 people on their computer, and I had 5 people on my team. So there's a lot more concentrations per square inch onto the couple of us. Literally, picture all of Commodore watching, 5 of us, one of us with long hair, no shirt on, doing the work, you know, while carrying cases of beer in the front door, no less. And I honestly don't know what it was like to work anywhere else. I just thought I was so in the moment that I didn't know what it was like to work for another company or even not be who I was right at that time. It was just kind of like the right place to be.
And now the Commodore building is the home of QVC.
Yes. Yep. The matter of fact, some of the people that used to work at Commodore work there today.
Did they really?
Yeah.
What do you mean, like building people, administrators?
They worked in the shipping department and stuff.
They
got jobs there.
So. Oh, at least they stayed local.
Yeah. So we still get together, some of us old Commodoreites. We didn't this year. Everybody's pulled in several directions. Several of the engineering people, we still get together, and it's like, when'd you get gray hair, man? You know, but it's, you know, I've gone from having long hair, I now shave my head, and I'm referred to as the disembodied voice because they'll swear I'm still not in the room even though they hear me talking.
It's great stuff. Well, Bill, you guys did a great job back in the day. You know, this is coming from someone who I had a VIC-20 and a Commodore 64 and then I had an Amiga, and I really grew up with those machines. And I think a lot of Linux people too, but people in general are in the same boat as me. You know, we learned a lot from those machines. And for that, I thank you.
Oh, well, yeah. It was a cool thing to be even near, to be a part of. And I worked with some really brilliant people and some really good people along the way that it was just it's such, especially as I got older and I look back, it's just such an honor to have worked with those people and even been around them a little bit.
Do you still live in the Westchester area?
I live in New Jersey, unfortunately.
Oh, where do you live in Jersey?
Unfortunately.
What's that?
Where in Jersey?
South Jersey. It's just kind of an ugly, you know, when I first moved here, I thought that the state flag should be like a rusty muffler and a dead squirrel laying alongside the road. I mean, it's not pretty at all. Interestingly enough, I ended up getting into emergency medicine. A couple things happened. I quit drinking in 1990, so I haven't had a drink since May 29th of 1990, which is the only, and I think that goes along with the Commodore. It turns out about half of us are alcoholics as we look back and count up, and we should start holding our own meeting someday, you know. I'm a recovering Commodore engineer. So part of that was I couldn't keep living my life the way I had and survived, and so I made a change and came to a complete and abrupt halt and said, now what the hell do I do with my Friday and Saturday nights and all of this? And I got into emergency medicine, and so I spent my Friday and Saturday nights running up and down the turnpike with the Mount Laurel Emergency Squad, pulling people out of the ditches and climbing through the back windows of rolled cars and things, and ended up working at the trauma center in the local area. And one day somebody said something. We'd been just real busy, and we were all tired, but you get kind of, you know, where you're kind of happy. But you're not happy, but you're numb, but you feel good that you did a good job. And mm-hmm. Somebody said something about being busy, and I was just like, no, man, I used to work for Commodore. This is nothing, you know. And so it just kind of went right along with that, you know. Where do you go after you've been there? Well, shit, for me, I ended up in a trauma center in the turnpike late at night. You know?
But that was a step down in pressure, right?
Yeah, and you know what? It got me kind of I kind of felt part of Jersey then after I took enough people out of the cars and stuff like that. And one of our cops took around in the vest, and it's like it was one of my cops, one of my guys, you know. And it's like, oh crap, I'm from Jersey. Not only that, now I get along with cops. Jesus Christ, you know. So, but you know, any day that doesn't kill you is not a bad day. Yeah?
Exactly. Count your blessings and you go move on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the trauma center, I really did develop the attitude of, you know, any day you wake up and you don't have a closed head trauma, it's not a bad day, you know. I don't always have a good day, but I haven't had a bad day in over something like 3,067 days, you know.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Especially living in Jersey.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my wife doesn't understand why I want to leave, but I do have to get us out of here someday.
Is she from Jersey?
Yes.
Well, maybe that's
you want to move back to tell her you want to move back to the United States. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's like, you know, I need a Wawa nearby. I'm like, honey, they have one in Montana somewhere. We'll move near it. Really. So I look forward to the day when technology really does. I can move to like the upstate Pennsylvania or something and do my job while sitting at a Linux station at home, you know, and email it off to somebody and call it a good day's work, you know?
Well, why can't you do that now?
A plug for Linux.
There you go. Why can't you do that now?
Well, I'm still associated with an ISP, which means I basically need to be in driving distance.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no emergency too small, it can't wake you up.
That's true. You can't.
And you know what's funny with that is having been on a pager for an ambulance squad for so many years, if you call, you know, we have an emergency line, they'll ring to my house under certain conditions, and I'll defy you to figure out if I was asleep or not at 3 in the morning, because you wake up completely if you've been on an ambulance squad when the pager goes off. Phone rings, I'm already sitting upright, and you're like, hello, Bill Hurd, you know, so it's all good, you know, it all kind of feeds the same reaction.
Well, Bill,
back to the days.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. Some of your stories have been great. You know, we'd love to hear more in the future, and we'd like to have you back at some point in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if there's a way where I don't talk so much, monopolize the line, that'd be great. We've got to figure a way to slow me down. And
actually, that's
and,
the whole
and
point
make
of having
it more
you
relevant,
on.
And that'd be cool.
Yeah,
what's
that's
that?
That's the point of the interview.
That's the whole point of having you on, so you talk. You know, that's what our listeners want. They really like to hear the guests go just off and talk.
They can't stand listening to us.
If it's just us, they start sending us hate mail.
Hate mail again.
Maybe it's just me.
Always back to the hate mail.
Yeah, good thing we can trace that mail these days to who sent it, huh?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's true. That is true.
So, well, I do appreciate the chance to talk about the old days and how it even came about to be in some of the new stuff we're out there. You know, I'm dead serious when I say, you know, I look at things like the open sources and the Linuxes and stuff, and I see it all growing back through different branches of the trees back to, you know, the roots of where some of the stuff came from and some of those pioneers from the day. You know?
Yep. The thing about Linux that attracted me the most, it really reminded me of the old days of computing. You know, it's got that homebrew feel to it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Let me ask you a question, though. In contrasting that with looking at the non-open source or the non-open technology out there, like Windows or Apple, I mean, do you have that same kind of feeling for those companies, kind of relating to them too, or no?
Microsoft absolutely raised our standard of living. So there's no denying that I can make a PowerPoint presentation that people can see and go, oh, look, you know, and I can drag and drop and all these things that we really take for granted, you know, using a mouse to flip between windows and stuff like that. Hey, those guys really did it. Kudos to them. I don't mean to take away from that. It's just once a corporation gets into that cycle of needing to make new money, they have to make their product obsolete, you know, and force the new one down your throat. And therein lies, I think, the problems where, you know, I was fine around Windows 2000 and even experienced, I don't need a new one. And as a business owner, I don't need somebody telling me I need to buy one because one day somebody will send me a document I can't open from another company, and his whole company had to switch to it because one guy opened a document. So that's the issue. I understand it. I understand that they can't tell their shareholders they've made enough money. That's the problem, you know. So, but with that said, we shouldn't take away from Microsoft and Apple and those what they did bring us that we now do take for granted. Amazing. I mean, the rendering and the, you know, the watching a DVD on your computer shouldn't be taken for granted. I mean, the decompression and stuff that's going on in the rendering. Now these days we go, oh, look, it's a little grainy. Oh my God. You know, I mean, how many years ago we couldn't even do that? So I don't want to take away from it, but it'd be nicer if, you know, they didn't have to be so evil about it.
That's a great comment right there. They didn't have to be so evil.
Yep.
Well, that's a bummer. But, you know, I want to thank you for coming on, Bill. It's been fantastic. The stories have
been my pleasure.
Great. The people in the IRC are just ecstatic with the stories. They loved it, and it's great. Thank you very, very much.
No problem. And if you get some hate mail, forward it to me. I'd love to see it.
I'll send you over to take care of them.
That's it.
Yeah, me and my chair leg. I'll have to tell you that story next time.
You can put them through a wall.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Great having you.
You have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Dun, dun, dun.
And there you have it.
Bill Hurd.
Everybody loves the Commodore stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't have to get off, actually.
No, I'm here.
I know. I know you didn't hang out because I didn't hear the did yet. So, you can stay out if you want. We still
I didn't know if the radio show ended. I'll hang up now.
We end at 10:30.
We're on the internet. We just keep talking.
You
do? Okay.
Yeah, we have till about 10:30 till we have to get off one of our streams. But it's not unheard for a show to, you know, we could stay on as long as we want.
All right. Well, maybe I'll hang in the background here while I fix something, and then I'll probably at some point just kind of fade on off, kind of like we do in real life. How's that?
Just fade away. Fade away like the Commodore.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't a fade.
Fade away like the TI.
Yeah, the TI, yeah.
Okay, there. You happy now?
The Sinclair.
Last week, we went off on a tangent about MPEG 4 lib X 264 MPEG version 4. Wait, MPEG 4 version 10 codec. And I guess in a nutshell, libAV, what is it, libAV codec?
Yep, libAV.
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 AV provides it for FFmpeg, which is...
Say that 20 times.
Yeah, and the FFmpeg legal stuff. It's always up in the air. FFmpeg itself is covered under the lesser general public license, and incorporates optional modules that are covered under the general public license. There, there's the question as to whether it uses patented algorithms is kind of up in the air. I don't think there's ever been any challenge or proof that it has. There's been speculation that it's possible, but according to the developers, they don't know. You know, they're not lawyers, so they're not qualified to answer the question. I'm getting this from the FFmpeg fact, legal fact, so I'm just going to drop that into the IRC chat there so you can pull it out of there to find out more information about FFmpeg. I you know what? It got me thinking today as I was reflecting back on whatever the heck he was talking about, that technology that iPhone's using or whatever it is to stream.
You mean Andrew, when we're talking about the Kulu?
Yeah, about the Kulu being able, you know, he said it was AT&T, Google, and the iPhone that are really pushing whatever the streaming technology is. That works great. And is it FFmpeg? Is it Flash? I mean, is it MPEG-4 or Flash or what? I don't know. But I remember, you know, Stephen Von Nichols saying a year ago that in a few months none of this crap is going to matter about what format you're playing it under. DRM issues are going to be thrown out the window because they're going to want you to have their content. And I kind of see, like, keeping an eye on stuff that comes particularly through LX and a little bit on Dig. I'm seeing both of those. You know, I'm seeing one side, some of it's trying to push for DRM, like the IPTV. Is it the IPTV? The British? It was just in the forum.
Yeah, I think the British ones now are pushing for the DRM now.
I mean, they're restricting being able to use or view their videos, not only in just restricting it to the United Kingdom, but also on the what platform, and the question about whether Linux or FOSS software will be able to take advantage of the iPlayer of the what they're putting out, the BBC, the IPTV. They're concerned about DRM issues. They seem to be going down the route of restricting their content. And I've seen other companies that are being more lax on DRM, particularly the music industry seems to be, some companies seem to be embracing it. Walmart is now selling DRM-free music, although I hear it's highly censored. So
everything you buy at Walmart is censored.
Yes, unfortunately.
Music-wise.
But still trying to figure out exactly what he was talking about, but, you know, the FFmpeg is the way to go for the H.264 codec. The MPEG-4 version 10. So I just wanted to double up on that from last week. Yay.
Hey, did you guys see the new episode of the IT Crowd? They talk about software piracy and video piracy.
No, is it?
Yes, I did. That was funny.
Where is it? You get it done. I've never seen an episode of the IT Crowd.
Yeah, you got to go to BT Airlines if you know what I mean.
Okay.
BT Airlines.
Yeah, they basically, the police care more about piracy than they do about cannibals running around.
Well, how many cannibals are running around?
You'll have to watch the episode.
They're all from Germany.
Oh, I thought you were being serious.
You gotta watch the episode.
Dun dun dun.
It's episode 3, season 2.
What else is going on this week? There's a nice little discussion. I'd like to hear more opinions on this discussion other than Chess. Now, I really value Chess's contribution to this thread that was started. It was called... Oh, what the hell happened to it? Oh, cutting through the FUD patents and Trojan horses and the big brouhaha surrounding Moonlight, Mono, Novell, and Microsoft, their collaboration with regards to how that could impact the future of Linux. And the FUD behind it on both sides. I mean, Chess and Trolls have been posting. Of course, Trolls, anything that has to do with Freedom, Trolls will be posting.
Freedom, BSD, and SUSE.
Yes. And I would be interested to hear some other people's opinions, because this has been a hotly debated topic in the community the past couple of weeks. Coming off the heels of the Office Open XML, which I know I sent an email to JZA, and he's in the IRC right now. Would love to get him on one day in the near future to talk about his experiences on the Mexican Standards Board voting on OOXML. I'd really be interested to hear what his experience was and what his opinions were from that. Now, have any of you guys been keeping up on the whole thing regarding Moonlight Mono?
Yes, there were some comments made by Miguel that got a lot of people up in arms a little bit.
Yeah, obviously. Definitely. I mean, they have Miguel as being the Microsoft shill to the savior of Linux, and you know his name is denigrated and praised, and he runs the whole gamut of this. And you know, having met Miguel and having spoke with Miguel, I personally, you know, he comes off as a very, very, very passionate guy for technology and programming. And regardless of what path he would have chosen to go down, he seems to be the kind of person that is going to thoroughly explore and integrate whatever solutions he can in any way any way possible. You know, the sky's the limits with him. And, you know, and same with Nat Friedman in talking with them. I don't think, personally, that they're the spawn of the devil and the free software. They're the Trojan horse. You know, they're letting the gates open. But on the you know, flip side, it's hard to ignore Microsoft's past behaviors of embrace, you know, extend and extinguish, exterminate, whatever you want to say.
Didn't Nat and Miguel meet each other while they were both interning at Microsoft?
I don't know their history.
I think before. Yeah.
It's possible. I don't think there's a well planned out agenda here. You know what I mean?
I don't think so either.
I don't. But you know, I see the other side of legitimate concerns about not so much is it corrupting or tainting Linux as opposed to Microsoft trying to manipulate and control the adoption of other technology beyond their own, and then, you know, feeding a little bit, then pulling away and saying, hey, you know, if you want the real implementation, you come to us. Kind of like what they did with Office, Microsoft Office on the Apple platform. You know, you got it going on for so many years, and then finally they pull the plug on it.
Or they can go the route of Java, J++, you know?
True. Now, who just jumped in?
Yeah.
Oh, it's
Alexandra. How you doing, Alexandra?
What happened to JCA?
He died.
You like that better?
I need my name every time. That's cool.
He's dropping. Pat's all about dropping docs.
Absolutely. There is no docs anymore. We don't go by these hacker pseudonyms. We go by our real names.
Yes, because Pat just doesn't
no more
care.
AKA.
Pat doesn't care if you're hiding out from the government there, JZA. He's going to let them know exactly where you are.
I'm going to go get the reward money. Kidding me?
That's right. He hates freedom as long as it's your freedom, not his.
Freedom haters.
Hey, guys, I'm going to call back because it's my crap right now.
Yes, don't call with a piece of crap in your mouth.
It's the internet.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, I'll hear that.
Let's stop the show now. Get out of here.
Yeah, he'll come back and it'll be nobody.
We'll redirect him to, I don't know.
Just be completely quiet when he comes.
Boys
back.
Town. Dun, dun, dun. I wonder if I doubt it. I don't think Miguel's going to be at Linux Fest Ohio.
Now, either. Was that one of the senders of the hate mail you guys talked
no,
about?
No, he's no. Actually, no. He's one of the developers. He's a developer, right, for Open Office?
He works for the Open Office project.
He works for the Open Office project. Version. Yeah, he's down there in Ecuador right now, isn't he?
Is he in Ecuador?
I thought he was in Ecuador.
From Mexico.
But I thought he was like in Ecuador or something.
I think.
And then he flew back to sit on the standards boards in Mexico City for the OOXML vote. Yeah, no, he's not a hate mail listener. The people who send us hate mails generally wouldn't call into the show.
Yeah.
They just send hate mail.
Generally, yeah.
Yeah, particularly to Link. Mostly to Link.
I was going to say, almost, I think all of it goes to Link.
Yes.
I think so.
Just about, yeah.
For some reason, they like to target Link.
They usually just say that I don't ever talk, so...
They
can send me hate mail.
The rest of us can say the most heinous things, the most god-awful things, but they'll always attack Link for some reason. Because Link hates freedom.
Hates freedom.
Having him around then is like good for everybody else. It's like taking ugly people with you to the bar when you want to score.
That's right.
Pretty much, yeah.
Exactly.
It's we say what we want to say, and then we duck behind Link, and he gets all the torpedoes thrown at him. And then we dust him off, and that's next week.
Oh, he's reusable.
We're on next week.
He's our Burning Man.
And that's the way it goes.
Code reuse is good, I'm told.
Yes. Sometimes, you know, we got to patch Link up there, and maybe you know, let him buzz around without being assaulted for a couple weeks. But you know, just push him back out there. The version 2.0.
That's right.
And that's the way it goes. We haven't had any hate mail in the past couple of weeks, have we?
Been quiet, I have to say. Yeah. We'll have to say something controversial.
About what a fine job the RIAA is doing, perhaps?
Let's not go crazy.
Bill, where do you stand on the whole DRM issue? Do you think it's justified in any degree?
I asked my lawyer, you know, because I had an opinion that just seemed so completely different than what's accepted. You know, what obviously is accepted by the law because they're getting away with it. And so I said, well, what's wrong with this picture? I asked my lawyer, who is a Republican, but he's a fellow medic. You know, we've done calls together, so we trust each other. And he said, well, frankly, the problem is that they are judge and jury in the way they're doing that. And I'm like, thank you. I mean, I wouldn't have found the civilized way to say that. But the problem with that law is that the people who are doing the enforcement are also the ones that deemed that you're already guilty by the time they do, and it circumvents all that constitutional crap we don't hear enough about these days. So it's and then, you know, to find out that they're all for rootkits and that kind of thing that by law is illegal, okay, I want your lobbyist or whatever it is you're doing to get away with this. But that's where I stand on those guys. And I don't know when it'll end. I haven't seen the erosion where there's a court case lately where somebody finally did win one or two things, but I haven't seen the start of the slide that says that they're finally catching up to them.
Yeah, DRM 2.0 is coming out with all the high def stuff now. You know, we got this format war with, you know, the high definition DVD players. Honestly, the whole thing is just a vehicle to you know, put more DRM up for everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I love gadgets. I love technology, you know, but I look at that and I say I have no rush to go into that, the whole, you know, high-definition DVD thing. You know, stand back and let, you know, the chips fall where they are, you know, where they may.
The thought that I have to be afraid, you know, I've got an older computer in the house that's got probably an earlier version of Windows Media Manager, whatever the hell it's called. The fact that I don't ever want to let it update because it will update to some kind of snooping type software. Why do I have to be afraid of my program that pops this nag window that says, do you want to update now? Up now. There's something wrong with that. My understanding is if you do let it update, you can't go back, you know, once it gets the DRM hooks into your machine.
Right now, there's. I don't think there's any. Well, the whole legal DVD playback on Linux is a big issue to us, you know. Technically, you know, we're breaking the law for playing DVDs in our Linux boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not an approved device or et cetera, et cetera.
I don't know. Is BSD in the same camp as that or no?
Turn down your radio.
Hey, noob. I'm back.
Noob.
Noob.
JZA, everybody.
So, back to Miguel. Well, basically, I don't know what's wrong with Miguel. Miguel is basically screwed up in the head right now. He's been hanging with too many Microsoft buddies, and he just drank the Kool-Aid. And, well, yeah, he's high right now. By the way, I'm not in Ecuador. I don't know who. What is Ecuador, by the way?
Link said that, not me.
Look at Dan pointing, changing it.
Well, you're not in Mexico, though, right?
Hail, right?
you're not in Mexico. Where are you?
I am in Mexico.
I thought you weren't in Mexico there.
I was not in Mexico City, but I am in Mexico. I hate Mexico City. Why would I go there?
I don't know.
I mean, these guys have it hard enough living in New Jersey.
I was going to say, it's the New Jersey
Mexico
of Mexico.
City is like, yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's like the garbage city, man.
Where are you right now?
Yeah. I'm in Guadalajara, which is a really long word to say.
But a fun word to say.
Yeah.
For some reason, I heard Guadalajara, and it just rang as Ecuador in my mind. I don't know why.
Same thing, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Right, Dan?
Think about Tequila.
Dan has a problem
that's
with
like
Matt.
The town of Tequila is like 20 minutes away from here.
Okay. My mistake.
Perspective.
I apologize.
Yeah. So what? Oh yeah. So Miguel. Well, he basically stepped in during the meeting. It was pretty funny because actually I don't see it from me. What they've been trying to do for the past few years now, they tried to get open source turned against itself. So one of the things that Microsoft put was the document response for the ISO in Thailand. So the Thailand document basically made several quotes of some of the Red Hat engineers talking about OpenXML, and then they took their comments and put it against, like, supporting their own standard. Then again, this guy came up in the blog later and said Microsoft just got it all wrong. They were cynical about it. So what they did is basically during the meeting, it was awful because none of the people there. I mean, you can get like the guy that served you the tortillas outside of whatever. They got that guy and put it on the committee and said, "Oh, he's supporting the." I mean, you got a whole. Whole lawyer office inside their committee, and it was a technical committee. It's supposed to be for engineers or for people that actually have a say on the standard, and they have lawyers, they have students from XYZ University, and they were just want to like overcrowd the place and just say vote yes, kind of like what they did in Sweden.
Wait a minute.
So
wait.
Basically, that was one of the biggest challenges.
JZA, wait a minute. Now, that tortilla guy, he might have been a tortilla engineer. Like, we have sandwich artists.
Yeah, he might, but I highly doubt it.
We have sandwich artists in the United States. Some people might call them sandwich engineers. They work at Subway. That tortilla guy might have been an engineer.
Yeah.
Don't denigrate him just without the
cool
facts.
To have a tortilla standard.
Yes. So they actually are you just using that? They didn't actually go get the tortilla guy to come in and vote, did they? In Mexico City.
Well, they got their Microsoft partners, but the partners were doing nothing at all with the, that. They had nothing to do with the actual standard in itself. They were doing Visual Basic applications, for example.
Uh huh.
They were not even doing .NET. and they got a lot of people trying to do implement .NET, and just because they do websites in .NET, oh, for some reason they have to do something with OpenXML. So they're not developers of the, they're not even developers of the actual core. They were just Microsoft partners. They just rallied them up into the meeting. If you ask any of them, they will have no idea what XML is.
So, I mean, did you get to talk with any of these people there?
Yeah, I got to talk to them, and basically, it was, I mean, at first sight, you can see that nobody actually read the standard. One of the guys said, who raised the hand who actually read the standard, and nobody raised their hand, which, I mean, it was cynical the way they were just, I'm here to vote yes, I don't care really what it's about. So, yeah, it was a little bit frustrating because even Microsoft didn't know much about it. I mean, there were tons of Microsoft engineers, I mean, not engineers, directors or whatever, president, vice president, whatever, and from Microsoft Mexico. And they didn't have any idea about the standard. They just have one guy that they brought from Miami that was dealing with interoperability, and the other guy that came from Microsoft part was Miguel. So that was we knew about it. We knew that they were going to bring Miguel into as the expert. And the funny thing is that Miguel, well, he, like you said, he's an engineer. He doesn't really care about rules or regulations or whatever. He doesn't care about patents. He doesn't even have a view on these kind of topics. So he entered the committee saying, well, to enter the committee, you have to register yourself. You have to go through a protocol where you actually have to say, I here want to participate in this meeting because I want to contribute technically to the meeting. So this guy didn't even make a submission to their registration. He just showed up, and I was like, "Hey, Miguel, who are you representing here?" And he was like, "Oh, I'm representing myself." Okay, did you actually register yourself to be in this meeting? No. And I just say, "Well, what are you doing here?" And that was it. He hung up. Oh, because he wasn't there in person, by the way. He was just doing conference call from whatever in the U.S. he's at right now.
So you didn't have to actually be there to vote? You can vote over the phone?
Yeah, I was there.
No, I mean, you could vote over the phone if you wanted to?
No, well, you can vote from wherever you are because the vote was not handled in person. You could submit your vote even before, which is something also that annoyed me, because you could submit your vote before the hearing. You know what I mean? So you could vote yes and just show up to the meeting and say, well, yeah, whatever, but I already vote.
So the Microsoft guys taking everybody out to lunch at the local titty bars? Paying for lap dances?
Right, exactly. Now, the thing is that Microsoft never really expects so much lashback from the community. We actually show up, and we came up to gather 68 votes against the standard, while Microsoft just accumulated 52. So we have a 10-ish difference. The funny thing is that most of the vote yes from Microsoft were, like I said, lawyers. And after the total count, all the lawyers start speaking. They never said a word during the actual technical hearing. They all came out after the technical hearing. And actually by that time, the meeting started at 4. My plane was leaving at 9, so I left that meeting around 7. And the meeting, I flew back to Guadalajara, came back home, turned on my computer, logged in, and they were still in the meeting. The meeting ended up around 1 a.m. in the morning. So basically it was awful. It was, I mean, a big, big chaotic meeting.
What time did they cast the vote?
With technical specifications or whatever. Right.
What time did they cast the vote?
What time did they what?
What time did they vote? Did they actually vote?
They voted by email before the meeting that same day.
So
they could have voted at 9 a.m. if you want.
So that meeting wasn't actually... Yeah. They didn't actually do any voting at that meeting.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. But then one thing, Microsoft will manipulate the rules and even confuse ISO people. They had a guy from the ISO representative for Mexico there, and basically Microsoft was agreeing to everything that we said, and they would say, that's cool as long as it's yes, but with comments. Then I said, hold up, you cannot have yes with comments, because basically when you say yes with comments, that doesn't really enforce anything. And then they went all up in rage saying like, you can't have yes with comments. As the ISO people right here and the ISO guy was like, I never seen it, but I know it has happened before, so... For that, yes, you can have yes with comments. Now, after that, after the meeting, we actually went to we didn't went there. We just called Geneva asking for, where is the ISO headquarters, asking for the actual regulations for yes with comments. And the only way you can have yes with comments is where the comments have nothing to do with the technical specifications. When the comments are, like I said, general comments. There are two types of comments, the technical comments and the general comments. So if you have a technical comment, you have to vote no with comments by default. And Microsoft in Mexico didn't agree with that, and they were pushing to get yes with comments. In the end, basically, the vote was no with comments, and Microsoft compromised themselves with what the regulatory government, which is the Secretary of the Economy in Mexico. So I don't know what concessions Microsoft gave to them, but basically there was a lot of that was behind doors, and the outcome was abstention. So, basically that was it. And Microsoft wanted to push Mexico to become a P member. Now, in the ISO, there are two type of members. There's the O members, which is observers, and P members, which is priority members, I think, or primary members. So in the ISO vote, if you are an observer, you cannot directly vote, or your vote doesn't count as much as a P member. And what Microsoft was doing was pushing the smaller countries that has never really had any deal with the ISO, and they already hijacked the whole committee to vote as yes and vote as a P member. So, well, those are the challenges, but basically what we're trying to do right now with FFII, which is basically the guy handling the No Open XML campaign, is basically just come down with ISO and say, listen, guys, your whole structure is being broken by Microsoft. They are not behaving in any way good to the spirit of the ISO. I think you guys should consider on just basically banning Microsoft out of ISO completely, just because they have been caught up in so many I don't know how to call it, breach of rules within the ISO, that will disqualify Microsoft as a member of ISO. So that's basically at the point that we are right now. Because, well, we won, and yes, if you look at the counting, they will say, well, we won by a tiny margin, but what really happened is that we got the minimum votes already that we'd get Microsoft out of the fast track. So there could have been more no votes, and at the same time, Microsoft could have been basically could have got more advantage out of the ruling.
Were you disappointed by that?
I'm a little bit disappointed because, well, you just face the whole corruption going on. At least in Mexico, you just have face-to-face corruption where they lost, and then again, they even can't come up with some neutral outcome. I would have expected the jury to be, or at least the ISO committee here in Mexico, to be more neutral about it. But even from the start, the leader of the guy in charge of the ISO here in Mexico was sitting right next between Microsoft CEO, Microsoft Mexico CEO, and another vice president. So once you even look at the way that the seats were configured, you were like already like, okay, this is not gonna be good. They basically have it in the pocket. Some of these officials,
but they didn't. Though they didn't get the vote. They still didn't get the vote.
They didn't get the vote. Yeah, that's true. IBM pushed very hard, and IBM is another one that can get their hands dirty with these people. So I guess that IBM just leveraged on that physical advantage and could provide some kind of pushback. But then again, it became a Microsoft versus IBM thing, which is very common at least here in Mexico. So it became like, if we didn't have IBM, the whole thing would have been lost. Just that IBM have more government officials in their pocket.
Uh-huh.
So from a engineering perspective, I mean, with you're talking about technical stuff, you became irrelevant because it became who can corrupt who faster, you know?
That's a shame.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the general attitude towards the whole situation and the community has been poor, but, I mean, are you in communication, have you spoken with other members of the board there? Maybe some actual ISO members who went to this, you know, expecting to have a fair process, and, you know, all of a sudden these other yahoos show up. I mean, how's the general feeling been towards all this, from your opinion, for the people who have wanted to legitimately participate?
Then again, nobody really participated away from Microsoft and Miguel de Casa from the Microsoft end. And from our end, there were the UNAM, which is the national university here in Mexico. They actually did a study on OpenXML, and also me, basically, coming up with all the technical stuff. Away from that, they were just ranting about, why we need another standard where we already have open document format, just basically general comments, not really technical. The only two technical, basically four technical people were the ones from this university, the National University, that did a study on this. Me basically coming up with the same comments that Rob Weir had on his blog and other people in Groklo that did studies, as well as Gary Edwards' opinions and Miguel's opinion on GNUmerics. Now, the thing that Miguel is saying is like, we implement OpenXML in just a few weeks in GNUmerics. But what happened is that, yes, they implement a translator that will put the actual text in the document. But if you have an Excel sheet, let's say, with a graph, you try to do that importing, and all you're going to get is basically the cells with numbers. You won't get any clip art, you won't get any graph, because all those graphs are depending on what Microsoft called the drawing ML, which basically is not, the specification is basically said, do it like Word 98. So it's kind of like an ActiveX. It's kind of like Microsoft HTML. I mean, yes, HTML works on other browsers until you have an application depending on Active, on what's the name of this, the framework they use? ActiveX.
Uh-huh.
So basically, the drawing, the clip art, and the graph and everything is the ActiveX of OpenXML. And that is just one example that say, well, I mean, Miguel is coming from the end that say, yes, OpenXML is very nice, they innovate in a lot of stuff, but this is not a rat race to say who is better. This is a rat race to say who is open enough. I mean, this is not a say, well, who is going to win because it's the best technology out there. This is a comparison who can be a standard or not. And that's what Miguel doesn't get. Miguel just say, well, it could be implemented with some limitations on everywhere, and it's better than Open Document, so for that, we should all use it. And I don't think that is what at least ISO or any standard committee should be looking at. So that's my rant. Oh, and I have another rant also. Microsoft OpenXML basically is, we're seeing that it's going to be a double lockup. If companies develop OpenXML, what they are really locking themselves into is on the XML schema, which the XML schema will only get compatible with what they have the product called SharePoint. Now, the real SharePoint will become the exchange of XML, in other words. I mean, yes, email is standard to a degree. Everybody uses email, but it's not email the problem. The problem, even Outlook is not the problem because you have pimps all over the place. The problem is not Outlook. The problem is it's Exchange servers. So the problem is not OpenXML. The problem is going to be SharePoint, where they lock all their data into these SharePoint servers that cannot speak to any other application out there that is not Microsoft compatible. What would mean that all your data will be locked down in this SharePoint Exchange-like lockup. So that is the real threat to the whole OpenXML, and that is what nobody's really talking about, and what is really going to bring the government, for example, adopting OpenXML. They will get their XML schema and data locked up into a non-conformant XML.
So, overall, OOXML was shot down as a standard this round. Do you have faith that it's going to remain or not become a standard through the process to
I have
occur.
Faith. Yes, I do have faith. But then again, my guess is as good as anybody else because the people behind it, which is ISO, they will have to come up with a decision within themselves whenever they want to go the route that Microsoft is pushing them, which is basically a lot of eruptions or disruptions on their actual regulations. And they have to say, okay, do we want to move forward with this and maybe put our reputation at risk? Because all these things are coming up where Microsoft is clearly telling their partners to come in and vote yes, regardless if they actually want to bring a substantial contribution to ISO from a technical or even a monetary point of view, because yes, you can be a member, but if you just came for to vote yes on this and then you leave, that is gonna affect ISO to a degree.
true. That's a shame.
It's like if you had a school, and yes, a lot of people came here, pay a lot of money, they get their diploma, and then they leave, and they're like, but guys, you have to go to classes. Oh, we didn't even care. We just came here to get the degree, and that's it.
That is true. It's a shame. See that happen. Actually, JZ, I have to get going, and we got to close stuff up. But,
okay, sure.
Thank you for coming on and clarifying a lot of this stuff up with us and giving us your account of the situation. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. It's great. I just want to make a plug. I'm flying again to Barcelona next week. There's the open office conference going on. It's going to start on Tuesday in Barcelona, in Catalonia, in Barcelona. And it's going to be great. You guys, I think you guys have a logo on it, so I want to encourage people there to click on it and look around. I don't think they can go to Barcelona. I mean, registration is already over. But all these talks are going to be broadcast and then are going to be put online. I guess you guys could just email the email that shows in the page, and you will get information on where you can actually go and watch the presentations. And they're going to be very technical, some of them. Some of the others are not that technical, but very interesting. So I encourage you guys to go and watch them, download the AUG file or the Fiora video, and get going.
So that's the openoffice.org conference in Barcelona on 19th through the 21st of September. Which would be next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
Yep.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, JZA.
All right.
You have a great
one. Take care, guys.
Have a good one.
One thing we got to mention before we forget on the way out from that
Ontario
email.
Ontario Linux Fest?
Ontario Linux Fest. When is that?
That is coming up on Saturday, October 13th. At the Toronto Congress Center.
Put that in a calendar, yeah.
Ontario Linux Fest.
So for a Canadian friend or Americans near the border, check it out.
Yep. You can look at their website at www.onlinux.ca. That's onlinux.ca. Post that into the IRC. You did. Also, the Mepis podcast has been added to the Tech Show site. Mepis.org/audio. Link, you were wrong why Warren went back to Debian again. He's doing it because he doesn't want to build Mepis by keeping pace with Ubuntu. He doesn't want users to have to reinstall every 6 months. So, anyway.
And with that, remember to mention that Mepis 7.0 Beta 4 was just released.
True that.
Dum 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 dum.
Dum dum dum.
Yes. All right. Mepis Linux. Everything else. Bill Hurd, JZA on tonight. Some really good stuff.
Good show, yeah.
We'll be back next week with Ohio Linux Fest updates.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Review.
Got over time to start rallying the troops.
That's it. Wait, who paid for the hotel?
Me.
How much do I owe you?
I paid for the hotel. Link paid for the airline tickets.
How much do I owe you?
Except for yours.
I believe it was 106, but I'll double check. I think I sent an email.
$1 million.
Is that 106 per person?
$1 million.
Is that 106 per person?
$1 million.
Is that
106? No, we got four rooms for $106, Dan.
Yeah. No, I'm asking, is that $106 per person?
I think that's what it came out to, yeah.
Okay. All right, so I owe you $106.
I'll send an email out and double check for everything.
All right. I do have a song for tonight. It is called I Want to Go Home by Samantha Murphy off the PodSafe Audio. Anything else before we cut out?
I think that's it.
All right.
That's it. Thanks. Everybody gear up for Ohio Linux Fest. Be there
or be there.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. Ooh.
Good night, everybody.
Have a good one.
Good night.
Night.
Good night. Bye bye. Oh, Dingus screwed that up because he took out. Yes, here we go. I Want to Go Home by Samantha Murphy.
We're not
going home.
This job's so boring. It's clearly not my calling. It's 7:30.
Tune in for the Dan Washburn reality show.
And I'm tired.
Right after the Linux infection.
It's so frustrating. This uniform is so degrading. I spend my evenings praying.
Tonight's episode. Dan picks his nose.
We had Dan words earlier.
Recording conversation.
It's not part of God's plan. Well, I want to go home, read Rolling Stone, eat a big snack, take a long nap, smoke cigarettes, have no regrets, leave me alone. I want to go home, talk on the phone, play my guitar, stare at the stars, dance in the rain.
Anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
And that is it. Is anybody else there? Anybody? Nobody? Everybody's gone? Wow. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. We will be back next week. Have a good one. Bye bye. Bye bye.
War.
We got little kids fighting. We got big kids fighting.
I should make a movie of it.
We got somebody
Gang
wants.
War.
To, yeah. Got the wife's making banana chocolate chip cake. So you're here to mix it for a little bit.
Should be no war about that.
Hello.
How you doing, Pat?
Hello.
I'm pretty good. How you guys doing?
How's our guest? Is our guest calling in?
Yes, he is. He's calling in.
Okay. That means
I got my son. I got my son sitting here with me.
Okay.
Watch your language, damn it.
Well, you got to ask Alan to watch his language.
He can't hear now.
So you put headphones on him too?
if you hear like a baby like making sounds and vocalizing, that's, you know what it is.
It's Alan.
That's Pat.
Right now he's chomping on his fingers, he's teething.
Hmm. Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Okay. This is going out to you and you, Alan, and Pat, because Link, I'm going to yell at you for this too, Link. Why not? You're closer than I am.
Yell at me.
Why the hell are they having Lehigh Valley Software Freedom Day at the absolute worst mall
I was going to say
in
that.
The area?
Where's it at?
Westgate Mall.
Where's Mall, that? Where nobody would ever think to go.
Nobody goes to the Westgate Mall.
Westgate Mall is up on Shanersville Road.
Oh, you mean where that the store is over, the clothing store?
It's the old folks' home.
Yes. The only people that go there are senior citizens speed walking or mall walking.
No, the polka guy goes there.
Okay.
Oh, there's some good media coverage for you right there.
I was going to go up there Saturday because I feel bad for them because, like, nobody's going to show up. And the people that do don't even know what computers are.
What?
I would imagine, though, it's probably because Lehigh Valley Mall wanted, like, you know, an arm and leg and your first child to set up a table there. That's just a guess on my part. I could be completely wrong there.
That's really unfortunate.
They even have a website set up. Somebody went out and registered lvsoftwarefreedom.org and set up a nice little website.
Yeah, it's got the lug on there, and I went Saturday for like the lug thing, and like nobody showed up anyways.
The lug meeting was Alan and his laptop.
it was me and the Nokia eating sushi, so.
So I guess you could put some sushi juice on a Nokia. It's impervious.
No, I eat clean. I try not to get things all over it.
Did you get KDE on it yet, though? That's the question.
No, I saw that today. I didn't look at that yet.
That looks pretty cool.
I'm not sure what size card you need for it. And there's probably a little more hacks because you got to be able to boot off the card. It's all the stuff I haven't really done to it.
Where the hell is the Pennsylvania Loco team for Ubuntu?
Well, no, it's probably Philadelphia would be my guess.
Well,
I think that's where it is.
Is it?
Could be.
I mean, I'm on their homepage. But I don't know where. I mean, it's Philly and SCPA upcoming events.
What I want to know, Dan, is where the hell are the pictures of your office?
Oh, yeah.
You know, your computer prawn pictures that you've been promising now for, what, a year? Has it been a year?
Almost.
The hell, man? You don't have any excuse anymore.
Yeah, right, I don't. Yeah, hold on, I'll be right back.
Especially since I just put mine up on the web. Not that it's very impressive anymore, but, you know. I don't see Alan's up either. You could do that too, Alan.
What, the,
The obligatory computer prawn pictures.
Oh, how bad my computer desk looks?
Yeah.
Oh.
Do it up, man. Come on, that'll be your one post this year.
No, I had another post. I had another post on there, didn't I? I thought I did. I don't even remember. I have to go like to the tech show page in order to find out where the hell my blog even is.
Your quarterly posting?
Yeah, well, I try to do it that way. Actually, I just realized I don't have Dan's. I have everybody else going to my blog lines feed, but I don't have Dan's on there.
See, now I had a problem with Dan's feed initially. It works now, but there was something weird going on there for a little while.
You heard me talking.
Mm-hmm. He just said, tech show.
Yeah. Who did?
Tech show.
My son, his first words out of his mouth are tech show.
Tech show.
Yeah, at least it wasn't Tim McGraw.
Enough, it'll be fuck.
I got the headphones on. He won't hear that.
Tech show, fuck. Just like Dan's daughter.
Yeah, there we go. Woo!
Let me see if I can get him to talk. Hold on.
I finally got the my myth box upgraded. Stop squeezing the child.
I thought that was Alan's myth box.
No, my myth box is running really good now. Watch it die on me in like 15 minutes.
Yeah, man.
I've been playing with Alan. Have you played with...
You've been playing with Alan, huh?
I thought there was something going on over there.
I was going to say, excuse me, cutting
the commercials out of your recordings. Have you tried doing that?
I just got everything up and running yesterday on it. I upgraded over the weekend and like it didn't work on it. And then they released a new one Sunday night.
You do not myth, right?
I do not myth. And that was like, I put it on last night and 30 minutes it was perfect.
Yeah, it's pretty good, man.
It was like a dozen questions and that was it.
Does Domus come with the NUV export by default? I can't remember.
It comes with the, it comes with the export on there. It has...
Not the DVD export, but the NUV export.
Yeah, it exports to XVID.
Yeah,
it exports to...
MP4.
It does MP4. It also does...
DivX.
It does iPod. So if you got an iPod, it'll export automatically for that.
Well,
including the 770 stuff now.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's not enabled by default, but all you got to do is put the job in there. And everything else is set for it. I haven't done that yet. That's the only thing I still have to do. I was playing around with it earlier, getting Samba and stuff running on it.
Yeah, if you go in, like, you pause the show that you're watching,
mm-hmm.
and then you hit the menu, there's a thing that's the edit recording. You could go in, you could set cut marks. And you do them around your commercials, and when you do the export... You set it to notice the cut marks, to follow the cut marks, and it'll get rid of all the commercials when you export it out. I exported a bunch of bizarre foods, that show on Travel Channel. You guys ever watch that? The guy goes around to all the different countries around the world, and he tries all the whacked out foods.
Oh, yeah.
I heard of it. I didn't see it yet.
So I recorded a bunch of them, and I did the cut marks, and I exported it out to XVID, and it got rid of everything, and it's nice and clean, and works fantastic, I have to say.
Let's see if it did some... Oh, I know where it is.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Why did it get quiet all of a sudden? And then everybody talks at once.
Well, it works right.
All we need is just an echo to come on top of it, and then...
Hey, Dan, we got the Memphis guys asking to add the Memphis podcast to your list.
We don't like Memphis, remember?
You're joking, right?
Hmm? Wait a minute.
Just got a notice tonight for Memphis.
where are they asking? Did they send an email?
They sent an email Warren sent an email with a press release.
Well, I don't see anybody asking
today.
In my email about...
No. I'm getting a private message tonight, see?
Who private messaged you?
Who is this person? I think it was one of the listeners who's into Muppets.
Who's that listener?
Goes by the initials of BJ.
Oh, BJ.
Yes.
No.
Yeah, I got one
no Muppets.
Earlier from him, and he
we are enemies of Warren replied. Now. Warren is our sworn enemy, remember?
You know, he's going to be at OLS, you know.
He better not come by our booth. He better not come by our booth. I swear to God, he comes by our booth. He's gonna come. He's gonna walk away with bruise marks all over him, pal. No. Seriously, I will definitely look it up and add it to the list. That's, I didn't know Meppis had a podcast. Can you have him email that information to the tech show?
He did. Let me see if I have it. I'll go and see if I'll go back and look for it.
Now watch, I will, we'll add it to the list, and it will, they'll close up shop the following week. Thank you, beautiful.
Really hot. Do you need more beer? Okay.
That'd be great.
My definition really
My wife doesn't ask me if I want a beer.
And you know what? She's gonna bring it to me, too. More than likely opened. So all I have to do is drink it. In fact, maybe she'll stand here and hold it to my lips.
Speaking of beer,
mine's not home now, so it's even better.
I got some Stella left over from the weekend.
Thank you. I guess that's an invitation to ask you, what were you doing this weekend?
I had my son's baptism.
Oh, yeah, that's right, that's right.
And I had the family come over.
Did you baptize him with Stella?
No, we didn't. We went to the church and we used holy water.
Dakota kick.
Holy water. The Church of Dan, maybe.
Everybody gets baptized with Dakota kick.
Yep. Hello, is that Bill?
Yes, it is.
How
hey, Bill, how are you?
Good.
You sound great there,
how are
Bill.
How things tonight?
Really?
Very good.
See, I just had to run into work. We had a typical hardware thing. Computer decided it wanted to be in the off state instead of the on state. Which is preferred over the smoking state.
Well, that's true. Did you leave it in the off state, or has it been forced into the on?
It is one of my people forgot that the box underneath the computer, underneath the desk, is a battery storage device and prevents fluctuation in the power line from putting it into the off state. In other words, somebody plugged it into the wall instead of the UPS.
Wow.
I'll be gentle with them. They have a hard enough job without me being around. So who all am I speaking with here tonight?
Don't worry.
Well,
be quiet.
I'm Pat.
Well, I'm Link. Yeah, I'm Link. Alan's on here somewhere.
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, we just had some real bad breakup there.
That's because everybody tried to talk at once. So. there's Pat, who was first, who responded first, followed by Link, and then there's Alan, okay. And myself, Dan.
Okay.
And we're about to start the show in 3 minutes. We're going to do our intro music. That takes about a minute and a half. And we'll get rolling right into talking with you, all the good stuff.
All right. Well, I'm assuming you guys are old hands at teasing people into talking about things and kind of leading stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Never.
Yeah. Well, I had about 4 pages of notes I carried to the VCF this year, the Vintage Computer Festival, and they got lost. And so it's kind of like that. I wrote all my notes down while my brain was still functioning about 6 or 7 years ago, you know, just little reminders of stories. So once I hear a cue, I'm good for a story. It's just I lost my self-serving cue of notes. You know?
No problem. This is a very, very loose show. you know, any tangents or whatever you want to go off on, feel free. That's what our audience yeah. likes. Anything you want to say, you don't have to worry about censoring yourself. Anything.
I think I have a cricket in my house.
I think you have a cricket in your pants.
No, I just all of a sudden I turned off the air conditioner, and all of a sudden every once in a while I hear just like
That would be a crotch cricket.
I had a foster brother that they called Crotch Cricket all the time. He'd run around scratching his crotch, and they always call him, the next door neighbor called him Crotch Cricket.
Yeah. Talking about crabs?
No, he didn't have crabs. I hope he did. He was only 11 years old.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the nickname for crabs, is Crotch Cricket.
Yeah, Crotch Cricket.
If you've been in the military, you've probably gotten them at some point, right?
I was in the military, and somebody brought them into the barracks,
that's what usually happens.
Yeah. Oh, so, we were there out in the range one time, and drill sergeant's like, all right, any questions? And a guy puts his hand up and goes, asswipe. I'm like, oh, my God, this guy just called the drill sergeant asswipe. And the guy's like, you may have noticed we have taken the toilet paper out of the latrine. That is correct. It is because of the infestation of crab legs. I'm sitting there thinking he called him an asswipe, and he was asking where the toilet paper was.
Oh, man. Oh.
Same latrine. It was Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I'm sitting there, and a tarantula actually walks out from under me. And I'm like, by the time you're in the service that long, you just kind of look down at it.
Keep it as a pet.
Well, they actually took one and stuck it in a drill sergeant's sugar can that he would open without actually looking into it to see if it was sugar or not, and that was cute. That was, made me glad I was in a different barracks.
Oh, man. You know, the hairs on tarantulas are nasty. It's not the bite, it's the hair. That really gets into your skin. Oh.
Yeah, I heard something like that.
Oh. And they'll actually... they'll actually flick
their
hair
like
at you.
When they twitch or something, they can kind of
shoot
propel them or something.
Yeah, it's like getting fiberglass on your hands and stuff.
Right,
it cuts you a little bit and sticks in your just like that. Because I had a tarantula for a couple years.
Did you?
Yep.
I had a couple of
only Dan would have a tarantula.
As a matter of fact, back when I worked at Commodore, we had a couple of pythons. One was just dumber than shit. We named him Dildo. And I walk in one day, and Dildo is stuck to the carpet. He had accidentally snagged the carpet when he was striking at a rat or something. And as I watch, Dildo opens his mouth a little further, and his teeth point backwards. So each time his mouth opens further, it hooks further in the carpet. So now I got this snake face down, mouth completely open, stuck to the carpet. It took me 20 minutes with a pencil eraser and an 11-foot python wrapped around my waist to get that snake off the carpet. After that, I became, fucking Dildo,
Link has got some good ferret stories, right, Link?
All kinds of ferret stories.
What kind of stories? Ferret?
Ferret stories, yeah.
I'm trying to get it. One of God's oilier creatures, yes.
Mm-hmm. Very entertaining little creatures.
I had a rat snake for 10 years.
Did you?
And, yeah, I love
caught a black rat snake, and I still see him around, but they're kind of cool.
Yeah. He bit
they're
me.
Kind of yellowish-white under the chin?
Mine was a mottled color.
Okay.
A mottled color. And he bit me once. And, man, it didn't hurt. It felt like Velcro. It bled like crazy, and it just freaks
right,
you the heck out.
Right, lots of little tiny holes.
Yeah, it just freaks you out when they bite you because it's just like that whole... But it didn't hurt at all.
Right. Well, I used to distract him. If he'd be hungry and I'd open the cage and I've got a rat and the rat smell woofs in, he would strike at anything that moves. So I would like kind of use a T-shirt as kind of like to distract him. One time, this is the other one named Monty, which wasn't a real original name. He strikes the T-shirt. And I'm like, okay, you can have it. I walk in 20 minutes later, and Monty's got the whole corner of the sleeve of the T-shirt down her throat. So here I am again with a pencil eraser and an 8-foot boa or a python wrapped around my waist as I'm pulling this T-shirt out like a quarter inch at a time out of my snake's mouth. I'm like,
pythons. And then they get so nice and large that you have to have more than one person hold them. What is it, like for every 4 feet or 5 feet of snake, you have to have a person, you should have another person?
Well, you could hold this. You actually did not want to let it wrap on itself. I mean, it could. By the time you realized something bad was happening to you, if it was your neck or something bad had already happened to you. But the problem is when the left foot snake get some purchase, get some leverage, it'll break any kind of cage you can make. And the thing was just shattering my plexiglass in the end and stuff. My plexiglass actually had 2x4s, like, screwed to it every couple inches, and it was still a fine piece to shatter.
Yeah, and then you hear the story about the person who didn't pay attention and let his little kid get killed by a snake or something.
Yeah. Well, the old, what was the guy's name that drew the real funny cartoons? He only did it for a couple years, but he had the real morbid sense of humor. He had, like, the snake in the crib that can't get out through the bars of the crib after it swallowed the kid. Well, this is Garf. What was that guy's name? And we had his comics up all over Commodore because we just had this morose, deathly sense of humor, so it fit right in. The Far Side was the name of the comics. That's the thing.
Oh, the Far Side.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
That's evil.
Yeah.
We should probably start the show before all these great stories end up on the AUG and not on the MP3.
Oh, yeah, we haven't started Commodore stories yet.
No, we have. All right, you guys ready? I'm going to start off the introduction.
Hold up. Do it, man.
The show intro, and then we're ready to roll. All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3. Actually, wait. Alan, do you have a backup recording going or somebody?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
just to be on the safe side. Just all right. Safe side. All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It is on.
Ah.
Try it again.
You know what? I'm gonna start over to count. 5, 4. I knew I shouldn't have pressed that button. I should have just double. All right. 5, 4, 3.
Recording
2,
conversation.
1. What was that?
That was me
Gizmo?
running a backup recording through Gizmo over here. So.
All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.